Broadcasting worldwide from an undisclosed location high up on the Rocky Mountains, here are your hosts, Chris and Cherie Geo.
Welcome back, hour number two, right here on True Frequency. It is November 8th, 2014. Joining us, we have our dear friends Christopher Everard and Max Egan. We're going to talk about the New World Order. What exactly is the New World Order? As I mentioned before, we did a New World Order broadcast back in 2010, and I believe both Max and Chris joined us on that panel, as well as many, many other people, Jack Blood and several others. And we discussed the New World Order as we saw it back in 2010. That's further research into this New World Order agenda has revealed some very startling revelations, to say the least. In the first hour, I also discussed how we were on a station at one point that was taken over by white supremacists. And the rhetoric was literally calling people Jew pigs and then snorting into the microphone. It was bad. It was so bad that we branched off and created TFR on our own, because we didn't want to be associated with that. But I've had this hypothesis that people like that, who use that kind of rhetoric, are injected into this realm, whether it is through a knowing of what they're doing, or maybe they're just useless idiots, or useful idiots, one or the other. But I believe that this is ultimately created by the power structure, because when we get to the root of the matter, we really are talking about an Israeli and Zionist control. And when you start to connect the dots, you do see this large plan that is an Israeli Zionist New World Order. But as soon as you start talking about that, you get categorized with these white supremacists. See, that's what they're there for. They're there to make you so disgusted with what they're doing and doing things that are so deplorable to anybody. I would say that judging somebody based on race or color or religion or culture or any of that is pretty deplorable. But they do this in order to ultimately hide the truth and make people reluctant to talk about what we're going to talk about in the second and third hour of the broadcast. So I just wanted to make a big distinction between what those people are doing and what we're doing here on this show. On this show, we are getting to the root of the matter. We're getting to the cold, hard facts. And the facts are going to take us wherever they may take us. And if the people that are doing this, the Zionist control, if they believe that they are something special because of a culture or because of a religion or because of a race, that's their belief. That's their racism. What we're saying here is that the race doesn't matter. The bloodlines don't matter. What matters is that these people believe all of this, and they are putting plans into action and doing things that are crimes against humanity in order to ultimately bring forth this New World Order agenda. We have Max Egan on the line with us. Max, how are you doing, sir?
I'm good, Chris. Thanks for having me on again, brother.
Absolutely. How are you feeling today?
Oh, getting there, mate. Slowly recovering. I've been very, very ill. I've been down for the count with meningitis, and it's a slow, slow recovery process. I tell you, like, I'm not. Apparently, I don't have meningitis anymore, but I still don't feel anywhere near well. It's just a very, very slow process getting back on my feet, getting my strength back. I can't believe how much it's knocked me back, actually. So, but I am recovering. I'm getting better. I'll come out stronger for it in the end.
Good, good. That's good to hear. That's all we really can do at this point, is when we start getting hit with all these tidal waves of negativity, whether it's physical negativity or spiritual attacks, we have to take it and strengthen ourselves from it. And you are truly an inspiration. Now, what I find odd, and I don't know how far deep you want to go into this, but this seemed to happen right at a point where you were going back into Gaza. Do you want to go down that road, or it's totally up to you?
Well, it is. It is very, very, I don't know, I can't help but question it, because I came down with this illness right as I was supposed to be going into Gaza Strip. I actually postponed my trip into Gaza for an unrelated reason, just for a week. I only postponed for a week because I wanted to make sure I got safe passage across the Sinai. And then 2 days later, I came down with this this illness in it. I can, you know, I was a mess, you know, medical attention and all sorts of stuff. And had I gone to Gaza, had I not postponed, I actually would have been melting down with meningitis as I was entering into Gaza Strip. So I would have got there, I would have had no medication, I probably would have died in Gaza, I would have taken meningitis to Gaza and infected all of them, and I can't help but wonder about the timing of the whole thing. It came out of nowhere as well. I mean, meningitis is something, you need physical contact to contract meningitis, you know, like it's saliva or body fluids or something like that. So I haven't been in contact with anybody, so I have no idea where I got this from.
That is very strange. What's the situation like in Gaza now? I know you had a lot of contacts. We did hours and hours of broadcast on the subject. What's your YouTube channel really quick? Because I know you have a lot of those posted at the YouTube, so people can check those out if they're interested.
Oh, my YouTube channel is The Crow House. The situation in Gaza at the moment is pretty bad. I mean, after the incursion that Israel just directed at them, I mean, 51 days of intensive bombing, we're told that the death toll is 2,500 or something. It's much, much more. Much, much more than that. There's still a lot of people that are unaccounted for that'll be trapped under buildings. So you're going to find it's tens of thousands of people that are missing. At the moment, Israel has closed all the borders into Gaza. And on the Egyptian side, General Sisi has actually bulldozed all the houses adjacent to the border. And he's thinking about digging a moat along the border. So they're basically turning Gaza into a supermax prison. Everything that, every agreement that was made to bring about the truce has been broken. Israel's broken the ceasefire every single day since it started. They've been firing on fishing boats and firing on people, just their usual stuff. So it's very, very bad at the moment. And now we've got, people calling for a two-state solution. We've got all these countries now standing up saying they want to recognize the Palestinian state. And these are people that never gave a damn about the Palestinians before, and now they're saying they want to recognize a Palestinian state. So that should be a red flag for most people, because if a Palestinian state is recognized under the current division, then it will be a two-state solution. And this tiny little Palestinian state will be only one false flag away from being stomped on by the pariah that is Israel, that is right next door, and it will also legitimize Israel. If they create a two-state solution, then that will be the end of Palestine. You know, the whole country is called Palestine, and it needs to be one country, and whether it's Israel or Palestine or whatever it's called, it needs to be one country under democratic rule with equal rights for all people. Not a Jewish state, not a Muslim state, but a democratic state with equal rights for all. But it needs to be one state, not a two-state solution. It won't work. This Jewish state will not work, and if they do succeed in creating a two-state solution, it will only work to the advantage of the Greater Israel Project.
This is really heartbreaking to hear what's going on and seeing what's transpiring before us. Israel is at the heart of every single religion, and right now they are tearing down the mosque in order to build the third temple. And
we're talking about it.
Yeah, that is just begging for this World War III apocalypse situation that we're ultimately looking at, that they're trying to provoke in order to emerge the rulers of the world. I mean, is that pretty much where we're heading?
Well, that's what they're trying to do. I mean, the whole Greater Israel Project is what it's all about. That's what this whole Middle Eastern conflict is all about. The Greater Israel Project, it's a paper that was written by a man called Oded Yinon back in the 80s. It's called A Strategy for Israel in the 1980s. And you can read this document and you'll find that it's what's being played out in the Middle East now to a T. The whole document basically says that to survive, Israel must become a regional power, and it must affect the division of the whole area by the dissolving of all the existing Arab states into smaller states.
Hold that thought, Max. Let's elaborate that on the other side. We'll also bring Christopher Everard on. The Greater Israel plan, the Zionist plan for the Middle East. Wow. Don't go anywhere. Everything is centered around the Middle East right now, or around the Israeli area as well, Israel, Palestine, and they're setting up their building blocks for something. All the chess pieces are all set up strategically for a complete takeover. Max really opened my eyes yesterday in an off-air conversation we had, and I want to get into the current events here in this segment. Next segment, and then I want to get into the history, how we got to where we are a little bit later in the show. But I want to bring Christopher Everard on as well. Chris, how are you doing, sir?
Absolutely fine. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Loud and clear. How is everything over at EnigmaTV.com?
Very, very good. We're in the middle of a thunderstorm at the moment, and I'm updating the servers so that we've got HD video coming from SSD flash drives to make the documentaries and the movies play a lot smoother. And I'm just making new TV shows right now.
Ah, fantastic, fantastic. So we were discussing, as I'm sure you heard, the Greater Israel plan, the Zionist plan for the Middle East. Have you had a chance to look into that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something which I've been covering very, very closely. I've actually just written a new e-book that investigates how Israeli families like the Sassoon family, that's the same family as Vidal Sassoon, and also the Saatchi family, they're the richest art collectors in the modern world. They are Iraqi Jewish families, and I've written a whole book about the Yazidis and the Kurds and their strange religions and their strange beliefs, and how Kurdish people are actually kind of embraced by modern Israeli people, even though that they are not actually, strictly speaking, Jewish. And really what we're seeing is we're seeing a continuation of the Kingdom of Jerusalem that was actually established in the year 1099. So really, basically, we have to look at the Vatican, the Rothschilds family, and Buckingham Palace. These are the three factions that have influence over Benjamin Netanyahu. And, you know, Israel does not have a king and it doesn't have a queen. It just has a prime minister. And the reason for that is because he takes his orders from higher up the ladder. And at the moment, it's really the Rothschilds and Buckingham Palace which are formulating a lot of this policy. And we are going to see a modern version of the old Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Kingdom of Jerusalem included Lebanon, large parts of Syria, including Aleppo, which is, you know, probably been in the news just recently, big chunk of northern Egypt. And the two blue stripes on the Israeli flag, at the top and bottom of the flag, they represent the Euphrates River, which is in Iraq, and the Nile, which runs through Egypt. So this is a long-term plan, and we are actually seeing the Kingdom of Jerusalem as it used to be, which was originally formed by the Knights Templar, coming into fruition today. And they took over Iraq, and, you know, they're actually going to, you know, create this modern version of the Kingdom of Jerusalem, which we now call Zionism.
Max has spoken about this in the past, how we're basically dealing with Khazars. We're not dealing with the actual Hebrew bloodline, but they're instead the false Hebrews, the fake Jews that even Revelations talks about. They talk about the synagogue of Satan.
Yeah. Well, what you can see, and this is, you know, I'm not making this up. This is absolutely something that you can verify yourselves. Just go online and check it out for yourselves. We have seen massive carnage and murder being inflicted by one faction of Jewish, one faction of the Jewish population onto another faction of the Jewish population. For example, 6,000 Sephardic Jewish children were deliberately overdosed with X-rays. 6,000 of these Sephardic Jewish children were basically, well, they had their brains boiled with X-rays. There's a documentary film about this, and this really happened. And yes, there is a power struggle within the, you know, the Hebrew families. So it's not just a situation where, you know, there's outside influence. They have been murdering themselves.
Yes, I have seen that throughout history as well. Now, the idea that Netanyahu is controlled by the crown and the Vatican, I would say that, yeah, I mean, I agree with that to a certain extent, but in my opinion, it's all one monster. It's all one monster with several different arms. I've always said this since the very beginning, and to people like Jordan Maxwell and others who say, oh, it's the Jesuits, it's the Vatican, it's the Pope, it's the crown, it's this and that. But really what it comes down to, and Max, correct me if I'm wrong, but they're all working together for the exact same agenda.
Well, they're all working together, but they've all got their own agenda as well. Like for example, you look at if you look at the Greater Israel Project, and you look at what happened with the invasion of Iraq, for example, I don't think the American government went into Iraq with the plan to divide it into three sectarian states. I think they went in there with the plan to promote instability in the region and secure control of the resources and hopefully maybe put in a puppet regime. But then you'd have the Zionist influences that basically manipulate things from the side, and we end up with what we've got now. And you end up with ISIS, which ISIS has gone in there and effectively turned Iraq into three sectarian states. It's kind of divided into three. So you've got a section for the Shiites, a section for the Sunnis, and a section for the Kurds. This is the way they do it. See, the whole thing, the whole Greater Israel plan, it operates on two essential things. It's to survive, Israel must become the imperial regional power, and it must affect the division of the entire area around it into smaller states. And it does this, and how small the states will be will depend on the sectarian composition of each state. You know, how many people are there. So they stir up sectarian hatred. They divide the whole place into smaller states, and then all these smaller states are fighting each other, and so that kind of legitimizes Israel's existence because it appears to be the only stable force in the area when it's the one who's gone and destabilized the whole thing. And what Chris said about the two stripes on the flag, this is exactly right, the Nile and the Euphrates. This is the plan for Greater Israel. And it includes Syria, it includes Jordan, it includes the top of Saudi Arabia, half of Iraq, parts of Lebanon. This has been the plan for the whole time, and this is why they've gone in there and done things the way they have. It's all part of the Greater Israel Project. And even there was another document that was called Israel's Sacred Terrorism. It was written by a man called Livia Rakash. And it's based on the memoirs of Moshe Sharet, former Prime Minister of Israel. And it basically outlines the 1978 invasion of Lebanon to a T. It's exactly what they did, and it's kind of a smaller, condensed version of this Yinon plan. And the Yinon plan was also outlined by, you know, way back as far as Theodore Herzl and Rabbi Fishman in 1947. I mean, this has been going on for a long time. It's always been the plan to go and destabilize the entire region to create this Greater Israel Project, you know, and that's what it's always been about. But they're all playing against each other. I mean, everyone's got their own agenda.
We've seen the actions of our recent history play out exactly as the documents have been written. So we have to put two and two together and make four. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back speaking with Max Egan and Christopher Everard about the Greater Israel plan, the Zionist plan for the Middle East. And unfortunately, we are seeing all of these plans coming to pass. And the next step is tearing down the mosque and building a temple there, a Jewish temple for this Jewish state. And as Max said, as long as there is a Jewish state or a Muslim state, it's always going to be chaos. It needs to be a quote-unquote democratic state or republic or something like that. That's not based on religion. I think the best thing for the United States was the separation of church and state, even though the two are still merging together. But there should be separation of church and state throughout the entire world. Actually, a whole separation of people and state, how we take it to that level too. But for the average person out there that needs to be governed by somebody, the separation of church and state ultimately is the only way that we'll have a halfway decent society, because these people are – you know, what they do, and this is just my opinion, but – I don't think that they really believe in Judaism. I don't think they really believe in the idea that the ideas of the Talmud and all of that. These are ideologies that they use to hook young and stupid people in. Same with the Quran as well, these quote unquote extremists. And they use them to hook these people into these ideologies to further their agenda. These people are, as I've said many times over, Satanists in the truest sense of the word. Because they're all about the self. They're all about taking complete control, hoarding all of the resources, and have absolutely no regard for human life or for any life whatsoever or for planet Earth. These people are Satanists. They're not Jews. They're not anything else. Max, any thoughts?
Well, look, what we're dealing with here, like when you look at the whole Khazar Empire, that's who these people are. They're Khazars, and they've basically hijacked everything. They've infiltrated into Christianity. They've infiltrated into Judaism. They've probably even infiltrated into Islam along the line somewhere as well. I would suggest that Pope Bonifaci, who introduced the Unum Sanctum Trust, was most likely a Khazar. And they've infiltrated into everything. This is where you've got Christian Zionists, you've got Jewish Zionists, you've got this whole sort of mottled empire that's sort of all over the world. It's infiltrated everywhere. And they're using basically the supremacist ideology that's outlined in the Jewish faith. They're using this to construct their New World Order. And they're using the blanket of anti-Semitism and all sorts of things that they've created themselves. I mean, the whole concept of anti-Semitism, this is a Zionist invention. It's a Zionist invention. And, you know, Zionism is very anti-Semitic. It's gone out and destroyed all of the Semitic races, and these people aren't actually Semites. It's very clever the way they've done it, but they've constructed this whole system, and they've kind of hijacked everything. And the reason I believe they're using Israel, it isn't because, you know, they really want to form ancient Jerusalem or anything like that. It's because this is the most strategic place on earth. This is the center of all the ley lines. If you look at it, it's the center of the earth's landmass. You can strike any nation at all from this place. And if you can put into the minds of the people the concept of the chosen people and the goyim, then this is what you get, you know. And these people believe they're the chosen people. These Khazars are more zealous about following these ideologies than the actual Jews are, but none of them actually believe in God. It's quite amazing, really, the way they've done it. They're kind of weird thinking people, but they've constructed a very, very clever plan, and they've hijacked everything, and they've had the whole world fooled, looking down rabbit holes and looking for someone to blame. And it's all about destabilizing the world and creating tension and breaking up all of these states. I mean, look what they're doing in Ukraine. They're breaking Ukraine up. They're trying to get Russia involved in this conflict now. And if anyone hasn't seen Putin's speech the other day, I recommend they go and look at Putin's speech. He did the most incredible speech the other day. This is probably the only world leader speaking sense at the moment, which is quite an amazing thing to say. But they're creating this whole tense situation everywhere to break everything up, to collapse everything, collapse all the economies, collapse Europe, collapse Russia, collapse everything, and create this empire of chaos with this one bastion of freedom and control in the middle, which will be Greater Israel. That's the plan. But it's run by the Khazars. And I would suggest that even the British royal family are probably related to these Khazars in some way. I mean, it all seems to go back to this empire. All the research that I've done over the years, going back through Hebrew lines and going back looking at what happened in Egypt and so many things, this Khazar history is the most hidden history and the most repressed history anywhere. And when you step back and look at it and you see how they infiltrated, and then you look at how the global geopolitical climate has changed, how the geopolitical climate has been molded, and you see what's happening with the Greater Israel Project now, and you go, well, here it is. This makes sense. This is really the only thing that makes sense. And, you know, it's all about merging all of the races on the planet together. This is why we've got such an infiltration of foreign races into Europe at the moment, which is all being run by Jewish advisors to all of these countries, amazingly enough, you know. And it's weird. You say to stuff, oh, you're blaming the Jews for everything. You're anti-Semitic. Well, hang on. I'm just looking at the situation. And you look and you go, well, there's these people, and they're all Jews. I mean, I'm not making it up. They just happen to all be Jews. Is this a coincidence? You know, it's not. I mean, and then you look at the Greater Israel plan, and you look at the whole doctrine of the Jews, the God's chosen, and the Goyim, and you say, well, here it all is. This is what they're doing. They're homogenizing the rest of the planet into this unstable, chaotic mess with Greater Israel in the center of the world's landmass as the pillar of stability and the center of control.
Chris, I know a couple of years ago we were together on a network where it was what I like to think of taken over by white supremacists. And then later, as we started to do research, we started to realize that there is something to this Jewish control. There is something to this Israeli control. Can you take us down your journey as far as that goes?
Yes. You know, just to add on to what Max has just been saying, the higher levels of Freemasonry are conducted in Hebrew. And ever since the late 1700s, we've seen Illuminized Freemasonry come about. And this has included many monarchs around the planet. For example, Catherine the Great of Russia was a member of the Bavarian Illuminati. Now, the Bavarian Illuminati was a mixture of Roman Catholic, or Judaic Catholics, Jesuits, Christians, and aristocrats. Now, you really start to get the picture when you realize that World International Freemasonry is a form of global religion based around secret Judaic ritual. And, you know, most of the Masons do not realize that they're involved in it, because the Hebrew aspects only come in above the 22nd degree. Once you go beyond the 22nd degree level, then you start to realize that all the major characters that are being described in these Masonic rituals are Jewish. Now, the central character is King Solomon, and King Solomon was the king of ancient Israel. Ancient Israel lasted for about 700 years, and it was split into two nations. The northern part was called Israel. The southern part was called Judah. Now, King Solomon allegedly wrote several books that describes this pantheon of demons. And so the real religion behind the scenes is really pandering and summoning and invocating 72 major demons. And the books by King Solomon are owned by the European royalty. And we know this because you can go to the King's Library at the British Museum and you can see the actual books there. Now,
see,
the crown,
all of a sudden, now we're going right back to Egypt. There's something to this.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get more on the other side with Chris Everard and Max Egan. Don't go anywhere. Now, this is unbelievable. This last 2 hours just flew by. Final segment of this hour. But, of course, we're going to do our commercial free hour at truthfrequencyradio.com. So, everybody on GCN, Eve, you want to hear the remainder of the podcast, the extended hour, where we can really get deep into the information, head on over to truthfrequencyradio.com and check that out. Now, there is something to this bloodline war that seems to be going on. Chris, I think, a great job of outlining this. It really sparked something inside of me. This very thought-provoking Secret Space Volume 2, where you were talking about these generals going in with swords and chopping the heads off of certain individuals.
Yes, that's right. This has been going on. It's not really been reported as much as it should be, but there has been brutality, especially on the part of the British forces who have been occupying Mosul and Basra in Iraq. I mean, they've turned Basra into a kind of British home from home. And they're just literally terrorizing the local people. I mean, they're having their doors kicked in at dawn. There's regular searches. It's just disgusting. Now, you have to look at the history of Iraq in terms of how its treasury was controlled by Jewish people. Because when Saddam Hussein was shoehorned into power, by the way, Saddam Hussein never got to power without having, international help. And he got a lot of international help from Britain, from Buckingham Palace.
He also couldn't get weapons of mass destruction without Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, that's true. That's very, very true, yeah. And what happened is that Saddam Hussein came into power and he said, look, you know, the Iraqi treasury is being run by the Sassoon family. And he expelled tens of thousands of Jewish people. He then expelled the Kurds because the Kurds and the Jewish nation have, you know, an understanding between each other. And now a lot of those Iraqi Kurds are now living in modern day Israel. And so this jettisoned the Jewish control out of Iraq. And by doing that, Saddam Hussein signed his own death warrant. And at the moment, Buckingham Palace, the Pentagon, the White House thought, right, this guy is obviously not going to play by the rules. He's a dictator who's, you know, been a puppet, and he's done a lot of good things for us. And he's allowed British Petroleum and the Royal Dutch Shell organization, which is owned really basically by the Queen of England's cousin, Queen Beatrix of the Netherlands. Saddam Hussein allowed these big oil companies to siphon out all of the assets of Iraq. But then he got too big for his boots, and he moved in on Kuwait. And at that point, when he expelled the Jewish community, he, you know, I mean, basically the writing was on the wall. And this is why he was hung. And this is why, you know, he was a man who was murdered and judicially murdered because he knew too much. He just knew too much. He knew that there was a long-term British Rothschild faction and a Jewish faction controlling the Iraqi treasury. And of course, what does the Iraqi treasury see? It sees like 90% of its revenues coming from oil, which is all controlled by British Petroleum and Shell. So that, in a nutshell, is what happened in Iraq. This then set off a domino effect, and we have seen really basically this disgusting situation just recently where this Sisi guy, who basically, I mean, I'd never even heard of him, and all of a sudden he's taken control of Egypt. Not last August, but the August before, more than 30 million people took to the streets in Egypt, and it was really a people power demonstration might. And there were Christians and Muslims and foreigners and people of all religions marching together. They cleaned the desk of Morsi, the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, and now all of a sudden we see this curious phenomenon where all of a sudden the Muslim Brotherhood are meant to be doing naughty things and minor terrorism acts, or actually major terrorism acts, in the Sinai northern part of Egypt, which borders on Israel, and especially it's got the border with Gaza. And it's actually Egyptian families that have been responsible for getting a lot of the medicine and a lot of the essential supplies into Gaza, and those supplies have been coming from Egypt. This Sisi guy is going to make a big mistake. He's already made a big mistake. He bulldozed a huge number of houses on that Gaza border. This is where all those underground tunnels are, you know, medicine, you name it. Aspirin, water, everything that was useful was going through those tunnels and supporting the population of Gaza. That border, by the way, there's also the Gaza airport, very, very close to that border. Now, they bulldozed all of these Egyptian people's houses. That is not really allowable in the modern Egyptian constitution. They had a 246-point new constitution that came in. Everyone's very, very happy about it. And now, bang, the New World Order in the shape of Sisi, who's been to see Obama, the New World Order in the shape of this guy has now trashed the advances which were made in Egypt. And this is a very, very serious problem. But am I surprised? No, because Egypt itself was under total British control right up until the mid-1950s. When you go to Egypt, you know, you run into people who speak perfect BBC English all the time, because that's the legacy. And if you ask me, is Sisi really in control? I'd say no. It's Buckingham Palace again, you know, controlling the tourist money. I mean, you know, Egypt brings in $4 million a day in good times just from tourism. So it's a very valuable and strategic country to have control over.
Max, would you say that all of these puppet dictators, Saddam Hussein, maybe even Muammar Gaddafi, Assad, and these others that we're now either – we've either overthrown or we're trying to overthrow now, were stalled by this Zionist Buckingham Palace control structure in order to bring them down in the later time?
God, I think Assad was. Bashar Assad, I think he was installed by the Zionists. I mean, I think Sisi, he's serving British and Israeli interests like to a T. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing just as bad, even more damage to Gaza than Israel, because these are Arab brothers. These should be supporting these people. And he's closed all the borders off, like you say, he's bulldozed all those homes. He's actually even thinking of digging a moat, as I was saying before, along the, so they can't possibly dig any tunnels because they'd have the weight of water above them. So there's no way they'd be able to do any smuggler's tunnels. Like I said, they're turning Gaza into a super maximum prison, you know, and it's being done right in front of the rest of the world. So Sisi is absolutely serving their interests. But I mean, Bashar Assad, I mean, I don't think he was installed. I think he was kind of a reluctant leader. He came to power and didn't really want to have the position that he's got. And his country has been devastated because he wouldn't bow to the Zionist control system. So this whole ISIS thing, I mean, ISIS is sprung out of nowhere exactly when Israel needed it. It's paved the way for Western intervention to go and carpet bomb the whole Arab world. So, I mean, who's controlling this? They're saying they're Muslim extremists. They're not Muslim extremists at all. They're killing Muslim people. They're killing women and children. All of these things that are banned by the Quran. They say if you do this, then you go to hell for all eternity. So obviously they're not religious extremists. They're just extremists. I mean, I would suggest that ISIS probably stands for Israeli Secret Intelligence Services. You know, or well, there's the American ISIS as well, which controls logistics in the Middle East. I mean, all of these acronyms they come up with. It's just a new boogeyman because Bin Laden had run out of steam, Al-Qaeda had run out of steam. But ultimately, it's all a product of the West anyway. These are the same people that they had in Libya, the same people in Syria. And incidentally, ISIS in Syria are actually being treated in hospitals in the Golan Heights by Israeli doctors. They're even paying their medical bills. So, you know, you've got these so-called terrorists being treated in Israeli hospitals. So who's running this operation?
Wow. Very well said, Max Egan and Christopher Everard, ladies and gentlemen. We will see you at truthfrequencyradio.com for hour number three. We're going to get into a little bit of woo in hour number three. We're going to talk about Antichrist. We're going to talk about things that are a little bit more out there, the Egyptian connection, and maybe even theorize or speculate on extraterrestrial involvement. We'll see. Love you. I kiss the one you love right now. You never know the last time is going to be. We will see you tomorrow with William Wright Crowe right here on the Genesis Communications Network.
Love you guys. See you tomorrow.
We can get in depth with Max Egan, Christopher Everard on the topic of Zionists and their belief that they are something different. They come from a different bloodline, and they ultimately have the right to rule the entire world. Now, the thing that strikes me the most is the fact that their Talmud, this is what they're teaching their children, is that the rest of us are quote-unquote goyim, and they are God's chosen people. I mean, just that mentality in itself, that they're God's chosen people. I mean, how arrogant do you have to be to say that you're God's chosen people? I find that to be quite disturbing, if you ask me, but that's my personal opinion. What I find even more disturbing, though, is they believe that quote-unquote goyim, which is the rest of the world, are to be used, stolen from, killed, and several other horrible, horrible things that you read about. And this is how they see the rest of the world. So it kind of goes in line with their own documents and their own doctrines. And so it doesn't come as a surprise that they're doing what they're doing. What does come as a surprise, though, is the amount of churches and Christian people and all, I mean, you've got the entire Western cultures backing these people who see them all as subhuman. If you can just understand just that one concept, then you can understand how demented this plan really is. But it goes way back to ancient history. As Chris was saying, it goes back to ancient Egypt. And there's got to be something that happened at some point in time with the bloodlines. There's got to be a separation of bloodlines somewhere. Whether you want to go down the road of extraterrestrials or not, it's completely up to you as the listener. Me personally, I think there is something to the extraterrestrial theory that they were created, at least this bloodline was created different, and it's something, I don't want to say too much because I don't know if we want to go down this extraterrestrial path or not, but I know that there is something very strange going on leading us back to Egypt, and again, Egyptian mystery schools too, because these people are mystics. They practice Kabbalah. They have some kind of secret knowledge that the rest of the world doesn't have, and they've been keeping it a secret. And that's ultimately how they've been controlling all of this. And this is what has sparked my interest in Freemasonry and in the Egyptian mystery schools, because we need to have the same weapons that they're using on us at our disposal, so we can use them so we can be on equal playing fields. But we've been conditioned to believe that Freemasonry and all of the secret knowledge that is kept in the Egyptian mystery school is evil. And we stay away from it. We shouldn't examine it. We shouldn't understand it. And we definitely shouldn't utilize it. Well, I say, why not? If somebody's going to fight me with a gun, I have to fight the gun. I can't bring a knife to a gunfight. It doesn't make any sense. I'm going to lose unless I'm on equal playing field. So that's my interest in Freemasonry. But then again, maybe there is something very sinister hidden in the belly of the Egyptian mystery schools that is damaging and is damning to an individual and to an individual soul. I don't know. I haven't gotten that deep, but when I do, I guarantee you, you'll be the first one to hear about it. Chris, do you want to pick it up from there?
I mean, if you want to push the time machine back and look at what is at the root of Egyptian mysticism, and then, you know, obviously this fed out to the nations as well, especially Israel, is that they have very weird gods. And the creation myths of Egypt talk about these amphibian, basically the male versions of these gods had heads of frogs, and female versions had the heads of snakes. Now, in southern what is now Iraq, used to be called Babylon, and in the southern part, right on the shores of the Red Sea, we have this big mound. It's a big mound of earth, and those mounds of earth exist all over Israel, all over Iraq, all over that entire area, and they're called tells. Now, what they did is that they buried, rather like a kind of archaeological time machine, lots of figurines made out of clay, showing us what these gods look like. And these are the famous so-called Anunnaki figurines that have been, in my opinion, misinterpreted by the late Zechariah Sitchin. But I think everybody's seen the female one with the head of a serpent, and it's suckling on its breast a very weird-looking baby kind of infant child.
Yes.
And these are hybrids. These are, they're partly amphibian, they're partly human, and they're partly reptilian. And they are at the base of the creation myths of Egypt. Now, that is not the first instance that these weird reptilian, amphibian, humanoid gods were first worshipped. These beings were well known in the ancient world. I'm talking about really ancient world, because we see depictions of frog-headed people and serpent-headed people going way back to about 11,500, 12,000 BC on cave walls in Europe. Now, where do they come from? They're obviously not human, and there are legends saying that they were really living at one point in Saudi Arabia. These amphibian, reptilian, humanoid gods were physically living in Saudi Arabia at one point, not far away from where Mecca is today. Now, what is the most sacred thing that we see in the Islamic world? What is in the Kaaba, in that cube-shaped building where the Hajj takes place and you get thousands of people milling around it? The most sacred object in the Islamic world is a meteorite that's come from outer space. That is what is inside that Kaaba. And you're absolutely right, in my opinion, to bring up this extraterrestrial aspect, because there is something weird with these ancient gods. Now, the amphibian aspect of these gods is where you can really start following through how they influence the ancient world. The amphibian Dogon god, is, as far as I'm aware, and all my research points to it, is the exact same type of god as the so-called Egyptian Ogdoad. Okay, so the Dogon people in Mali, they also receive teachings and technology and knowledge of astronomy from this semi-humanoid amphibian being, which is at the root of their own myths, and it mirrors almost identically the so-called Ogdoad gods of ancient Egypt. Then we go back to southern Iraq, and Ubaid, the Tell Ubaid, it's been such a rich archaeological area. We found loads and loads of those figurines. By the way, the lion's share of those figurines depicting these amphibian, reptilian, humanoid gods are all owned by, guess who, Buckingham Palace. And they're on display. Not all of them, but a large percentage of them are on display at the British Museum. And they are crown property.
Of course, of course. When we went to Iraq, first thing we did was take all the artifacts. There's got to be something to that. See, people sit back and they go, oh, aliens, yeah. What are you talking about? Well, this isn't what we're believing. This is what they believe, and this is the actions that back up their beliefs.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there was a crack squad of archaeologists, get this, wearing American camo uniforms, and they actually smashed down a brick wall at the bottom of a flight of stairs at the National Baghdad Museum. Now, not only did they smash that down and get into the storerooms, supposedly to take an inventory of what was there, but there was so really well, you know, perfectly designed robberies of the Baghdad Museum. The people who robbed the Baghdad Museum were not idiots. They were experts because the most valuable artifacts are never on show. What they do is they use companies. Most of these companies are in the United Kingdom, and they make identical photo replica, identical facsimiles of the world's most valuable artifacts. And that's what you see when you go into most of these museums. For example, the gold death mask of Tutankhamun, where there's four of those, and you can't tell them apart, and they've been made by British and German companies. And the same thing was going on in the National Museum of Baghdad. Now, they go in, they break in, and they don't steal the replicas, because they know that it's not worth stealing. They go for smaller objects, which you can put in a pocket, which are the original item. What were the first things stolen? Those Sumerian figurines. The first one that was recovered was tossed into a ditch along a roadside in Maryland, in the USA. It had gone all the way from Iraq. No customs checks. It obviously hadn't gone through TSA checks. Obviously hadn't gone through baggage x-ray. How the hell did that figurine end up in a ditch by the side of the road in Maryland, thousands and thousands and thousands of miles away from Iraq?
What's coming to my mind is a small diplomatic bag that nobody's allowed to search.
Well, a diplomatic bag is actually just a term. They do exist. But it is actually a term. If a diplomat says this entire aircraft is now under the guise of a diplomatic piece of luggage, the authorities have to go along with that. And in actual fact, in Germany, there was a diplomat, and he actually designated an entire aircraft as diplomatic luggage. They have that ability.
How much cocaine do you think was on that plane? Declared
well,
an entire aircraft.
Probably
I need the whole
lot,
plane.
You know? Oh, yeah. I mean, The other thing that has been found in diplomatic pouches, because there were two diplomatic pouches that were accidentally searched. You know, they thought that it was holidaymakers' luggage back at Heathrow Airport in London. This is about 4 or 5 years ago. And they found a huge amount of pornography. So,
of course,
you know, we know what's going on. Diplomacy does not really exist. I can tell you that now. All of these embassies around the world, what they are is they are involved in espionage and basically renewing passports. That's it.
You know,
it's not about international relations. It's about spying and gathering espionage and data, which is then handed back to corporations that are friendly to the politicians who gave those ambassadors that cushy job in the first place.
Right. Exactly.
Chris, before we get too far off subject, I want to get Max's take on the ties to Egypt, on the Egyptian mystery schools, and the Kabbalah, ultimately, and the Talmud, what all these people actually believe. Max, what are your thoughts on that?
What you were saying before, you know, it's interesting that the Christians allow themselves to be shafted the way they are by Israel. And a lot of this is because of religious programming as well, because the Christians believe they must support the Israelites because the Israelites are God's chosen people. But, you know, they've kind of been tricked into supporting the pariah, which is the state of Israel, by thinking they're supporting the Israelites. But, you know, it's been hijacked. So that's why you get the Christians doing that. And when you really look at what they're doing to the world, how they're balkanizing all the Arab states, they're actually destroying the Christian world as well economically at the same time, because they run the whole banking system. And again, it's the whole Vatican, Crown, Israel. It's all the one thing. It's all the one organism. There's just different methodologies that they use, you know. And a lot of the reason why the Israeli people are the way they are is because of the programming they receive. There's a film you should watch that I've got featured on the website called Defamation. If you haven't seen it, it's a film by a Jewish scholar who wanted to find out about anti-Semitism. He's an Israeli, grew up in Israel. Excuse me, he'd never experienced anti-Semitism. And so he wanted to make a film about it. And it documents how the school children are basically taken to Germany, they're shown all the death camps, and if they don't feel bad about being Jew, and they don't feel like the world hates them, the class basically gangs up on these people and cows them into believing that the world hates them. And they're programmed into this victim mentality, and they're told that the only reason they're a victim is because they're God's chosen people, and the world hates them for that. And so they're programmed into this. And so they believe that the best defense against being such a victim is to attack and stomp on everybody around you before they get you, because they hate you anyway, and they're going to get you because that's what they do. They're basically programmed to believe the world is populated by drooling Nazis who all want to kill the Jews. And that film outlines it very, very well. And it's made by a Jewish scholar. And it's basically victim and supremacist programming. So that's how we see it. I mean, you can trace, like I said, all these things. You can trace them all back to Egypt, and you can look at where all this comes from. As far as ancient gods and reptilian gods, what Chris was saying about these amphibious creatures, whether they were spacemen wearing wetsuits or whether they were actually amphibious gods, who knows? But they are depicted in all sorts of cultures, all over the Middle East, all over. Like you said, the Dogons, they had a god who was actually called Dagon, I think, who was the same thing. I mean, it's the same story. You find it all over the place. As far as alien intervention and stuff goes, and looking at this whole Hebrew line, I lean towards the Gnostic vision. If there's any type of alien intervention at all, I would suggest it's something like the Archons, because you find that this type of thing is mentioned, like if you look at Paul Levy's book, Dispelling Wetiko, how the Native Americans talk about this mind parasite that makes people do things that aren't in their best interests. And you look at what locks us down, the whole Freemason thing, the whole construction of our cities, the whole geometry that is pushed on us, how everything's square corners, flat surfaces, everything's like, you know, the Freemasons are always building things according to Euclid's 32nd supposition and all this sort of stuff. They don't know why they do it. They just go and do these little rituals. They place these stones at these angles and they do these things. They don't really know why. But all of this sets up these geometric resonances and these energetic fields. And this is a lot of what keeps us programmed into our left brain. the fact that we're subject to all this unnatural geometry all around us. Even when you look at our education system, we're taught that basic shapes are squares, rectangles, triangles. These aren't basic shapes. These are man-made constructions. Basic shapes are waves and spirals. You know, that's what exists in nature.
That's a good point.
That is a good point.
You don't see any of these things in nature. These are not basic shapes. These are left brain constructions, right? So it's programming. Once they've set up this whole energetic grid through the geometry that they force on us, it locks us into this. It locks our left brain into us. And it's all based on Kabbalistic principles. It's all based on understanding the flower of life and the tree of life and the whole Kabbalistic tree of life and all this sort of stuff. Even the money system, I believe, is based in Kabbalistic principles. And it's understanding the mathematical structure of reality, because this is a mathematically constructed reality. It all functions according to sacred geometry, the whole lot. It's all phi ratio and all this sort of stuff. We know this is a mathematically constructed reality. And so they've superimposed this left brain mathematics over us. And that's a lot of where our programming comes from. You know, giving our attention to these things that are so unnatural and our love for these things. Where do we develop this love for mechanics and machines and square corners and making everything geometrically perfect? Because reality isn't like that. Nature isn't like that. It's random. It's diverse. And yet we want to make everything geometrically perfect, and we separate ourselves from nature. Where did this come from?
Can you explain the ley lines just for the listeners that aren't familiar with that terminology?
Well, ley lines are the energetic lines of the planet, basically the power lines, the power grids of the planet. There's areas where energy flows around the planet that connects everything together. You'll find that there's a lot of very, very significant structures that are built on ley lines, built on the conjunction of ley lines, such as the pyramids. You find that these things are all on similar lines as well. You can actually trace a line around the planet and find that most of the ancient monuments on the planet are all on the same line. For example, Stonehenge is on the same line as the three pyramids in Egypt. You can draw a line straight through that and hit Stonehenge. All these things are on the same lines, and they're all on ley lines. You'll find that there's pinnacles, major churches, major buildings, you know, the Vatican, all sorts of things are on these major ley line points. So they know where these energy flows are. I think a lot of these things act like acupuncture needles. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what a lot of these pinnacles and obelisks and spires and things they put around the place almost act like acupuncture needles to direct the energy flow of the planet. I think it's all to do with the same thing. It's all to do with controlling the geometric resonance that we're swimming in as well. So I don't think it's just electromagnetic. I think the geometry has a big thing to do with it as well.
So, Chris, back to ancient Egypt, have you come across any research, and I'm sure you have, but research that suggests that they are harnessing these ley lines? Can you elaborate maybe a little bit on what Max was saying?
Yeah, this is absolutely true. These geomagnetic lines of energy, they go right the way around the planet. And water is a big, you know, sort of component to this energy. Now, most of the planet is covered in water. Even the dry parts, right under our feet, there's usually underground rivers, underground reservoirs. Now, it's been demonstrated, and I've got many videos from various kind of science expositions where you can get just ordinary water, you can split it into two streams, and you can actually generate sparks of several thousand volts from just splitting a body of water into two streams. Now, let's just look at the dowsers. The people that come along when you want to have a water well drilled on your land, you get some person who comes along with a pendulum or a dowsing rod, which is a twig, a Y-shaped twig. And what they do is they just use their experience to see where the shrubs and trees have been flourishing, and they start searching. And there is some kind of telepathic, interlocking kind of communication that goes on almost in the subconscious mind of that dowser person. And all of a sudden, where they walk over these underground streams of water, the dowsing rod twitches, or the pendulum starts swinging in a certain way. At that point, they stop and they put a small wooden peg behind the heel of the foot, which is closest to the point where that reaction happened. And then they continue. And then they average it up. And, you know, there's 10 million people in France alone that have borehole water coming out of holes in their gardens. That's 10 million people that used dowsing technology. And it is a technology. And when you look at the hinges, Stonehenge, and especially Avebury. Avebury is far bigger than Stonehenge. Avebury is the biggest circle, as far as I know, on the planet, and it's in Wiltshire, and it's only a stone's throw from Stonehenge. What you've got there is you've got this circular, very, very deep ditch. That's basically what a henge is. And they placed those stones in such a way that they were kind of redirecting this geomagnetic energy, which I'm sure is connected with water, into, I think, spiral kind of flows in this very smoothly excavated circular henge. And it's about a quarter of a mile across, or a third of a mile across in diameter. And they used to have processions there. And these processions didn't only take place on solstices and equinoxes. They took place at other times of the year as well. And there was healing going on in those places. People who were suffering from sicknesses, they were actually marched in processions into those henges. And that's because what they'd done is they'd created a temple of geomagnetic energy or geoetheric energy. And, you know, the atmosphere is full of water as well. Most of our brain is water. A huge amount of our blood is water. We are basically water beings. So, you know, this is really an area which science has been running a monopoly on this. The elite families have been running a monopoly on dowsing. How on earth do you think they find all these diamonds and emeralds and rubies? I mean, they pay professional dowsers, and some of these dowsers have different techniques. For example, I interviewed Yuri Geller once. His technique for finding diamonds, and he's done it many times, is that they fly him in a helicopter over the area where he thinks, you know, psychically he thinks that there's going to be a good chance of diamonds being found. But on his knee in the helicopter cockpit, he's got a map and he's got a pendulum. I mean, that's one technique. And these people secretly are, you know, they're earning millions of dollars for, you know, for actually pinpointing the places where this underground treasure is. Another way of doing it is by speaking and communicating directly with spiritual beings, because spirits have a reputation of knowing where buried treasure is, or seams of gold, or seams of silver, or, you know, it could be anything nowadays. It could be uranium, emeralds, rubies, you name it. And Joseph Smith, the guy at the root of Mormonism, he was earning his money as a dowser. And this is where the whole legend of him finding these golden plates came from. And there was a biographical book about Joseph Smith's mother that was published, and she fairly and squarely says, you know, yeah, my son used to go round to the local farmers, and he used to draw magical symbols on parchment and to pin these little fragments of parchment onto his clothes, and he used to do rituals. And in actual fact, you can actually see those actual parchments with those magic symbols that Joseph Smith was using. Now, we have to ask ourselves, what is Mormonism at its root? Mormonism is really a flavor of Freemasonry. Many of the handshakes are the same. Many of the symbols are the same. They elaborated things. They actually created their own Mormon language, their own Mormon alphabet at one point. And, you know, they've got their own kind of way of going about things. But at its root, it is Freemasonry. And what is the root of Freemasonry? The root of Freemasonry is essentially demonology coming from Chaldea, which was a province of old Iraq called Babylon, and that's where we see these mounds of earth where you see these strange clay figurines of these gods. I mean, where did they come from? You know, they're partly reptilian, partly amphibian, partly human.
And here we are.
This is a, yeah.
I was just going to say, here we are full circle, right back to Iraq, right back to Israel.
Oh, yeah.
Right back to this entire plan, which we're seeing playing out through the ages. Literally, this is a plan that have spanned over thousands and thousands of years. And you did a film, The Antichrist Conspiracy. Cherie, weren't you saying something about the Antichrist?
Yes, definitely. It does look like they're going to tear down Al-Aqsa and rebuild the third temple. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, Daniel, the book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, they both talk about this very thing. Can you explain to our listeners the story behind the rebuilding of the third temple and what that means for the rest of the world?
Yes, absolutely. The rebuilding of the temple, first of all, the Wailing Wall that you see on the TV, and amazing. I've got images of Mitt Romney, Obama, George Bush, all of the world's major leaders, including Prince Charles, also wearing a yarmulke, visiting the Wailing Wall. It's amazing. Now, where do you see any photo opportunities of these world leaders visiting, say, the Kaaba or any of these Islamic shrines? They don't. So you can see that just with those photo opportunities with those world leaders, there is a bias towards Israel and a bias towards the Kabbalah and a bias towards the base religion of King Solomon. Now, that Wailing Wall is a fragmentary ruin which was linked to, I think it was the Second Temple. Now, the very first temple of King Solomon had the two famous pillars at its entrance. Jachin and Boaz are the occult names given to these pillars. And people can't understand, why is it that pillars, which, you know, are meant to be just supports, have become very important symbols within this Solomonic, magical, Masonic system. The reason for that is because one pillar was an anode and the other pillar was a cathode. They were basically discharging static electrical energy from the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant was actually invented in Egypt. It's not really Jewish, but it was the Levite priesthood who built a tent called the Tabernacle, and that's basically the Ark of the Covenant, and there's not one of them, there's loads of them. They were banks of Leyden jars, and they were primitive ways of collecting this geoelectric atmospheric static electricity. And that was discharged in an ark between those two pillars. And this is how, you know, people like King Solomon, you know, displays of power like that, arcs of electricity to the peasants of that time. I mean, this put these people on a pedestal. I mean, you know, the peasantry at that time, they didn't read or write properly. And here's this guy, you know, he's got arcs of some strange power going over his the pillars of the entrance of his temple. That's where Royal Arch Freemasonry comes from. The arch in Freemasonry is actually the arc. It's an arc of electricity. And this is all to do with the Ark of the Covenant.
Wow.
Wow.
Very profound. I did not realize all of these connections, but you're really tying everything together, Chris. Max, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting stuff. I love what he was saying about water before. Water is so important. Have you ever heard of Victor Schauberger? Of course you have. There was
I've got two of his books.
Amazing, amazing man. You notice some of the water electricity experiments he did, Chrissy. There was one where if you actually get an S bend in a creek or a stream, and you build a little ford in the middle, a little rock ford, so that the current, because the current spirals, the current will be spiraling one way, and once it goes over the Ford, it spirals in the other way. It spirals in the other direction. So you create a positive and a negative flow. If you run a electrical wire out of one side of the Ford and out of the other side of the Ford on an S-bend, it actually generates electricity just by building a Ford in the middle. Experiments like this, absolutely amazing, absolutely incredible experiments.
It is.
And the stuff, the damage that they're doing to the water on the planet, the way they're polluting the oceans, the way they're fracking the groundwater, I think it's incredibly relevant. Because water has memory. Water is like the RAM drive of the planet. It's like the RAM drive of this whole experiment. You know, your body's 85% water. Everything you experience is encoded in the water of your body. This returns to the groundwater. All the water contains all the memory of everything that ever happened. And there's a very, very definite and concerted effort to destroy the collective memory of the planet, I think. That's a lot of why they're attacking the water.
Yeah, I mean, we are living on a water planet. I mean, basically, a huge area of the planet is water. Even the dry bits, as I said earlier, you know, is...
Yeah, it's all water.
What you see is... Yeah,
yeah.
Our
bodies are 85% water. It's just a few chemicals and this electrical impulse, which you experience is you. So it's incredibly important. The water issue, incredibly important.
And then you have trillions of liters of moisture in their atmosphere as well. Now, as the planet rotates, the atmosphere does not rotate at the same speed as the actual, the physical planet itself. The atmosphere obviously has swirls and movements, and there's also
drag.
The Gulf Stream. And these reactionary forces against each other create the buildup of charges of electricity will emanate as lightning, and also these other phenomena, which we've only just started studying now, called sprites. A sprite is a mysterious jet of energy that shoots up into outer space every time a lightning bolt actually goes from a cloud and touches the ground. And these sprites have only been filmed a few times, and it's really a new area of research. But Nikola Tesla and several other scientists have realized that, you know, this is an unlimited source of electricity. I just started reading one of Nikola Tesla's books. It's called Polyphase. And it's, you know, I mean, it on the surface, the book looks pretty boring. It's all about polyphase circuits. But what he says in the first chapter is fascinating. He says Niagara Falls could actually power all of the electrical needs of Canada and the USA combined.
Yeah,
that's
amazing
just
stuff.
Niagara Falls. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's an electrical universe. It's an electrical universe, and we can tap into that. We can absolutely tap into that power. Coming back to something else you were talking about before, getting back to the whole Israeli question and the supremacist ideology, and something Chris was mentioning before about extraterrestrials, and I said I tend to lean towards the concept of the Archons if there's extraterrestrial intervention, simply because it's backed up and referenced by so many other cultures. But there's an interesting way of looking at this as well, because if you look at the story of the Archons and you look at the head of the Archons, whose name was Yaldabaoth, apparently Yaldabaoth made a covenant. Yaldabaoth had another name he goes by, which was Yahweh or Jehovah. And if you look at the concept of ego is where the Archontic influence is able to get into your mind and take over. When Yahweh made the covenant with Abraham and promised him the land of Israel, he basically dispossessed him of his heritage, which was the earth, because you can't own any part of the earth. You know, the earth is the earth. But when he promised Abraham Israel, he dispossessed him of the earth, and he created that supremacist mindset in him, and then Abraham's line went out and dispossessed everybody else. And when you through the money system, the concept of ownership, they dispossessed everybody. All these countries started appearing and borders started appearing and people started saying, this is mine, you know. And when you look at this whole concept of God's chosen people, well, perhaps they are, but perhaps the God that chose them was actually the head of the Archons, Yaldabaoth, who is in fact a insane, demented alien who doesn't have humankind's best interests at heart. And that seems to be the way it gets in. And the way they get it into people and program is through things like I said with the film defamation. They go and they absolutely brutalize these people into believing that they are the victim. And the only reason they are the victim is because they're God's chosen. And that opens up this doorway for this mindset. And once they get into it, I mean, these people learn the Bible as a history book from grade school until they graduate. They actually learn that as the history book of the Jewish people. So it's an incredible amount of programming we're dealing with here.
Well, it certainly is. It certainly is. I have to say that there are, you know, Jewish people not only living in Israel, but also all over the planet. They really don't like Benjamin Netanyahu. He's not the number one flavor with lots of people. They don't really like what he's been doing.
Well, absolutely. There's a huge Jewish population in Iran that are very, very happy to be there and have been, Israel's offered them money to do the right thing and be a good Jew and come and live in Israel, and they won't do it. They're very, very happy in Iran and a big Christian population in Iran as well, you know.
Yeah, and also in Egypt as well. There's 7 million Christians in Egypt.
Also, and in Gaza, people don't even understand there's a large Christian population in Gaza Strip. When I was in Gaza, there's one building that is it's on the corner of a block, and it's a mosque on one side of the building and a church on the other. They actually go into the same building and they pray together.
Yeah.
Right? There is no animosity between the Christians and the Muslims in the Arab world. So this whole concept of ISIS going and killing Christians, it's ridiculous. These are not Muslim extremists. This whole operation's run by the West. It's given the West the perfect excuse it needs to go and carpet bomb the Arab world, which is exactly what it's doing. You know, so who benefits, you know?
Yeah, I'd just like to say that the Christians in Egypt are the Coptic Christians, and the Coptic Museum in Cairo has to be the best museum I've ever been to. It's much better than the National Museum. And that is where you have the Nag Hammadi codices, these little philofax-sized books. They're covered in leather. And this is where, in the Nag Hammadi texts, which were only discovered, I think, in 1945. I might not have the exact year right. This is where we first... Yeah, 1947. This is where we see this concept of the archons and this lion-headed serpent... And Sophia, who is this female demigod, who her ego got the better of her, and she started creating beings without really God's consent. And she ended up accidentally creating this lion-headed serpent, who then, you know, went to a lot of mischief.
Yeah,
and the Nag Hammadi,
It's a fascinating story. It's a fascinating story, the concept of the Archons and Sapphire. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah. I mean, you've got several different books in that collection, which we call the Nag Hammadi text. I've seen them myself, you know. And I, you know, basically one of the main reasons why I went all the way to the Coptic Museum is just to see the Nag Hammadi text. But there are, in that museum, loads of other fantastic items to actually see. And, you know, you have a lot of amazing concepts within the Nag Hammadi creation myth, because it's not just talking about the creation of a certain tribe or the creation of a nation or the creation of a religion. It's talking about big concepts. It's talking about the earth itself, the Big Bang, and the planet cooling down. It's talking about the relationship between water and humanity and flora and fauna. It's absolutely mind-boggling.
It's absolutely
incredible.
It is, because it's a galactic scale creation myth, and you don't find this anywhere. It's incredible. Yeah. It talks about the creation of the earth itself, the creation of the human species, the creation of the human genome, the whole concept of the galaxy, the whole concept of the grand originator and lesser gods, and it's amazing, absolutely amazing concept. And it's interesting that Gnostic teaching has always been, squashed and attacked. As soon as it comes to prominence at all, it's been stomped out completely. Even the fact that the Nag Hammadi Codex was actually written in Coptic, which is almost like a Greek shorthand, indicates that it was written in a great hurry. So, and the Gnostics never really wrote anything down. It was always word of mouth. So this indicates that they were under a great deal of pressure to preserve this information. They wrote it down in a great hurry and preserved it in this cave. And then God knows what happened to them after that. But even the fact that it's written in Coptic shows how much of a desperate move it was, because it's very hard to convey religious and spiritual concepts in Coptic, you know?
Absolutely. Now, on the flip side, if we compare this galactic, universal, amazing, and very complicated creation myth that you see in the Nag Hammadi texts, if you then compare that with the base fundamental root of Judaism, what do we have? We have demonology. We have the summoning of the 72 central demons. You've got four, if you like, kings of hell. These are demons in the lower planes. And they, in turn, rule over legions of other lesser demons. What are they? They are mistakes that were made right at the very beginning of creation through trial and error. There were obviously errors, and those errors are the kilopoth. They are the husks, if you like. They are the shells of unformed souls. They're jealous. They're envious. They hold animosity towards humankind and also all creatures in the physical realm, because we can enjoy the whole thing of living on the planet, breathing and eating and flavors and having all of the great things about being alive. They hold animosity towards us. Some of them, some of these demonic entities even describe humanity as an abomination. And, you know, just look at the contrast between the galactic, universal, it's kind of psychedelic creation mythology of Nag Hammadi, and then you do the flip side, and you can see what was being taught in Chaldea. You see, the Chaldean province of Babylon, that was where astrology and astronomy came together. Excuse me. And there you go. One side is demonology, the other side is creationism.
Yeah, yeah. Good point.
Wow, this conversation is really taking a direction that I didn't think it was going to in the beginning, but this is absolutely amazing information. And Chris, you know, you keep mentioning demons and entities like this, and at first I like to think of them as extraterrestrials. I go down the Sitchin line of thinking, but now that you start to talk about this in depth, I can see how this is all pointed towards demons. We have Solomon, who created the temple out of 72 demons, the 72 demons of the Goetia.
Yeah, well, those demons, what happened is that there was a series of seances. I mean, I'm not making this up. You can check this out for yourself in a text called The Testament of Solomon. And The Testament of Solomon is an amazing text because it actually recounts the conversations that Solomon had between himself and some of these major demons. Through a series of seances, I think that he was using pendulums, the blueprints of the layout of that temple was dictated by these demonic beings who are the Kilopoth. They are husks of souls. They're malformed beings. And they dictated the blueprints of the temple, and outside the doorway of the temple, it's like a circuit board. They designed that as a circuit board. At one end, you had the Ark of the Covenant in its own kind of enclosure, and there was obviously, you know, metallic kind of conducting material laid into that temple, and that led up to the cathode and the anode, Jachin and Boaz, which are the two pillars outside the doorway. Now note, they're outside the temple. They're outside on the entrance with steps leading up to it, and that formed a kind of small stage for King Solomon. So there would be gatherings at certain feast days, and the peasants would watch arcs of electricity, and they think, wow, you know, this guy, he, you know, he's so wise, he can command the forces of nature. And this is essentially what that first temple was. It was a psychically designed building. And that got destroyed, and then, you know, because, I mean, ancient Israel lasted for about 7 centuries. And as I said before, it was divided. There was northern, the northern part was Israel, the southern part was Judah. And then it got taken over. I mean, there was all kind of schisms and cataclysms and invasions, and you even had the Mongols, you know, I mean, I'm talking about people like Genghis Khan coming into the area. It was complete pandemonium. Until the year 1099, then the Knights Templar turn up. Now, the Knights Templar had been sent. This is a very important thing. The Knights Templar were on a mission. They weren't just like lolling along in their ships and decided to stop off in Jerusalem and form a kingdom. No, they were sent there specifically by the Vatican, but the most influential faction funding the Templars and guiding what they did once they got to the Holy Lands were this bunch of rabbis in the south of France, specifically Provence, and also on the estate of Hugh de Champagne, who is one of the most prominent Templars. And a pact was done. And the rabbis wanted Saladin and the Muslims to be murdered, and wanted the Islamic influence of the Holy Lands to be completely eradicated, like the final solution of Hitler. They wanted genocide. This is the rabbis in the south of France. So they appealed to the aristocrats, because all the Knights Templar were aristocrats, even though they called themselves the poor Knights of Christ. These guys had vineyards of champagne, and they were very wealthy. I mean, Godfrey de Bouillon is one of the most famous Knights Templar. He had an enormous castle, and yet he's meant to be, you know, this kind of monk, you know, a warrior monk who's living a simple life. It's nonsense. And these rabbis wanted genocide on the Islam, on the Islamic population, especially Saladin, and they wanted to retake control over Palestine, Lebanon, especially Aleppo in Syria, which has just been in the news just recently, and also, obviously, Babylon. And so what we're seeing today is we're seeing the Gentiles, the Goyim troops, Air Force and Navy, and the taxes of the Goyim being used to fund a war against the Islamic faction to benefit the Jewish elite. And that is really basically what started in the year 1099 with the establishment of the so-called Kingdom of Jerusalem. It wasn't just Jerusalem. The Kingdom of Jerusalem included bits of Syria, the whole of Lebanon, all of Palestine, a chunk of northern Egypt, bits of Iraq. It's amazing. And there were, then what happened is that there was an enormous power struggle. Once that Kingdom of Jerusalem had been established, the Vatican, oh man, the Vatican was struggling against Buckingham Palace and also the French aristocracy, and they were all having schisms and squabbles over who was going to control this empire. It's known as the Empire of Jerusalem. And what happened is that Buckingham Palace basically played their poker game much better than the others. What they did is they got one of the French kings, one of the kings of Anjou, who is a big occult family. These people were having massive seances. They were inviting aristocrats, not only from other parts of France, but also other parts of Europe. And there's even medieval tapestries where you can see huge round tables. There's spirits coming out of the middle of the table. They're also there with the Holy Grail. And this is all tied in, by the way, to the same era as King Arthur and Merlin and Druidism. This was all going on in Europe at this time.
Wow.
And the Knights Templar came back with the texts that described the 72 demons of the Goetia. This was the pact. In exchange for killing the Muslims, the Templars and aristocrats and the Vatican were taught by the rabbis the high secrets of summoning these demons. And then that created a shockwave, an occult shockwave over the whole of Europe. And basically, witch covens were set up in the Danish royal court, in the British royal court, especially at Hampton Court, where you had Queen Elizabeth I, who is a murderer, by the way, and she had Dr. John Dee with his black speculum, where he could actually see the spirits, which he thought were angels, and he actually designed the Enochian language for, you know, what he thought were angels. And, you know, in, and also in Paris, Paris became the center of black magic. All of those black magic books, the French black magic books, were actually based on the texts that were excavated just near the Temple of Solomon by the Knights Templar and brought back to Europe. And wow, that's basically where we are now. You know, what I've just described is still going on.
Chris, I don't mean to cut you off, but we are at the end of the broadcast. We're going to definitely have to do a part two coming up because this has just been phenomenal. Max, anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
No, I'm pretty good. It's been a good show, though. It's been great to come on and talk about all of this stuff. I think, you know, people need to pay attention to what's going on. We're in a pretty precarious situation at the moment, and we got to step up to the plate. You know, we got a planet that's run by criminals. We all know this now, and it's about time we grew a pair, I think, and stood up and called them out on it. We've got to make a difference. We can't continue going in the direction that we're going. And I think the whole Greater Israel Project, I mean, I think they've shot themselves in the foot. I don't think they have any hope of succeeding. I think the whole thing is falling apart. The empire that the United States and Israel has attempted to build is an empire of chaos, as was aptly described by Putin in his speech. And I don't think they have any hope of succeeding at all. I think the wheels are falling off. I think that's why we're seeing such an escalation of conflict in Ukraine, and they're attempting to, you know, really push NATO and really get Russia involved in something because they're trying to distract the world because the world is waking up. So I think that their days are numbered, personally.
I
completely agree with you, yes. Yeah. And I think what we're seeing now is acts of desperation. And they're trying to maintain control and ultimately fight this consciousness shift that we're all experiencing. And we can dig into the history, and it's very enlightening too, for sure. But as you said, Max, we do definitely have to stand up and say we're not going to take it anymore. Chris, anything you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, I mean, I've really, really enjoyed this show. It's been a fascinating discussion. And, you know, as things unfold in the news, all I can say is that, you know, we're seeing really a continuation of the Kingdom of Jerusalem.
Yes. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this evening. We have to do it again very soon. Kiss the one you love right now. You never know when the last time is going to be, ladies and gentlemen. Stay tuned. Aaron Dykes and Melissa Melton coming up next, right here on True Frequency Radio, followed by Hangar 18, much, much more. And, of course, check out crowhouse.com and also check out The Chris Everard Show every Sunday at noon Pacific time. We love you. Guys, that was incredible. Thank
yeah,
you very
that was
much.
Great.
Yeah, it was enjoyable.
No problem. Yeah.
It was a good chat. Yes. Always nice to talk to you, Chris.
Yeah, you too, Max. You know, I wanted to say during the broadcast that the water goes in the opposite direction down Australian plug holes to what it does in the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah. So it's just amazing. I mean, we're just on this blob. We're like a water drop, a fragile water drop with a few bits
of
rock.
I wonder if you could sit on the equator and run a cable from one side of the equator from water to the other and generate electricity just from the reversal of the spiral eddies.
Wow.
I wonder if when you stand at the equator, the water runs straight down the pipe, doesn't spin.
I think it does. I think it does. It goes straight down the plug hole. Yeah.
I've got to get to the equator and check that out and maybe get something happening like 10 feet on each side of the equator and see if it spirals in the other direction, run some cables and see if it generates electricity. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Free energy for everybody on the equator.
Well, it's free energy for everybody, really. You know, like Tesla was saying, with Niagara Falls, you can generate gigawatts of electricity in a minute.
Yeah, well, he was so clued in, mate, with what he was doing, just extracting it from the field, you know, with these Tesla coils. I mean, knowing what the frequency was. Remember that little device that he made that he stuck on the wall of the building somewhere and it started thumping and it caused his whole earthquake everywhere except where he was? Do you remember that? It was this little device that he made. It was a little mechanical device and it was just a thing that went tap, 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 tap. And he put it on the wall of his building and it just started tapping. And it created this frequency and it created an earthquake in the town all around him except for the building that he was in. And everyone started, the wow. authorities came to the building and he just knocked it off the wall and before they walked in because he couldn't stop it. So he thought, oh, I better knock it off the wall. And as they walked in, he said, oh, it's a pity you didn't come earlier. I was just running this amazing experiment, you know. And they're going, well, yeah, but you've destroyed half the town. Look it up. Look it up. It was this little device that he created. I can't remember what it was called, but it was amazing, absolutely amazing. He was just messing around with frequency, and it was a little tapping device. If you Google Tesla earthquake or something, you should be able to find something about it. But it was amazing, absolutely.
That is amazing.
Yeah, he was incredible. Tesla.
You know, Victor Schauberger and Wilhelm Reich, there's hardly no radio shows and hardly no documentaries about them.
Yeah,
and I've got one documentary about Wilhelm Reich, and it's awful. It's the worst possible quality you could ever find, and the research is really bad. You know, these people unlocked a lot of the natural power on the planet.
I know Wilhelm Reich was incredible. That's a very, very sad story. Yeah. Wilhelm Reich. Had that dinner in 1930s or something to celebrate the all diseases. Was that Wilhelm Reich? That was what was that? A guy who built the scope, the telescope, the microscope. What's his name?
Reich. That was Reich.
That was Reich. I get them mixed up all the time.
He's another one.
That's a sad story, mate. Raymond Reich. I mean, Reich. What an incredible mind.
Yeah.
You know? And a doctor who was an engineer who could build that frickin' microscope. Have you seen the Reich microscope, Chris Gere?
No, I haven't seen it.
Royal Raymond Reich. He built a microscope back in the 1930s which could see live viruses, okay? Could see live viruses. And what he would do... He would put it through different light spectrums, right? Different frequencies. He put different filters over it until the virus became illuminated under a particular frequency of light, you know, because different light illuminates different things. And he would find the frequency of light that illuminated that virus, and then he would find the sound frequency that corresponded to that light frequency, and he would bombard the body with that sound frequency, which would cause a feedback loop, and the virus would shatter. The way an opera singer shatters a crystal glass, right? And they had a dinner at about 1936 to celebrate the end of all disease because he created this microscope which could literally see live viruses. Like electron microscopes can photograph live viruses, but they can't watch them in real time. He developed this microscope that could. If you go to Google Images and just Google Royal Raymond Reich microscope, you'll see this incredible device this guy built. And he ended up, I think he died in jail, Raymond Reich.
Wow.
And absolutely incredible mind and able to cure anything because everything is energetically based. It's all light and sound frequencies. All of reality is based on light and sound frequencies. It's all photon light and photon sound. And he figured the whole thing out. Absolutely incredible. Royal Raymond Reich, Wilhelm Reich, Victor Schauberger, and Nikola Tesla. These are four people that could have changed the world. It did change the world. And the suppression of their research is some of the greatest crimes that have ever been perpetrated against the human race.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have heard that story before. And I've heard more than one situation where somebody invents a cure for cancer, for instance. There was a doctor, a female doctor, I don't remember her name off the top of my head, but she invented a shot that it's an injection that cures skin cancers and other surface cancers like that, literally in a couple of hours, through her in jail as well.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, no.
Yeah, our whole history is filled with suppression of healers and
pushing the medical industrial complex. I mean, the medical industrial complex are not healers. They're there to keep you sick.
Right, but it's not the 1500s anymore. It's not like they're applying leeches and they're suppressing people by burning them at the stake. It's just different. It's just it's more cleverly designed now to make you want to be controlled by them.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I wanted to say, when we were talking about water, and you mentioned that the body is 85% water, and those experiments that they were doing where they were playing different types of music, sending different intentions towards different types of water, I think that's how they're controlling bodies, because we are made of 85% water, so different frequencies, even different intentions, you get a whole community living in fear, and maybe it both works together. Jesse Ventura was talking about those Gwen Towers, and the Gwen Towers projecting certain frequencies make a whole community feel one way or another. You can make them artificially happy or artificially sad or anything, and that affects the water that's in the body, and that ultimately affects the mind, and it all just moves in a big circle like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Being aware of it's half the battle, though. Like, being aware of all of the control grid is really half of the battle. You know, if you're aware of it, you can, you know when things are going wrong. You know when thoughts aren't your own, you know? I mean, that's a big part of it, you know? I really believe that we can shift things through frequency. I think we can shield ourselves through frequency, through knowledge, through no fear in what you do. I have absolutely no fear of this system. I have no fear of anything it can do to me, because it can't hurt me. It can only hurt my body. You know, so I know who and what I am. What I talk about often in the shows and in the talks that I do, when I talk about your perfection of what you actually are and how perfect we each are, I know this. I believe this. I live my life this way. It's like when Ken and I went into Gaza, when I was actually in London last time, a couple of months ago. Ken said to me, actually, Max, you know, there's a couple of things I didn't tell you about when we went into Gaza. It was actually a lot more dangerous than, and I said, hey, mate, I know. I already knew. And he said, really? And I said, yeah, mate, I'm not stupid. And he said, wow, really? And I said, yeah, but at that particular period in my life, I was so highly energized. We were bulletproof. Nothing could have stopped us. Nothing could have gotten near us. And all through that whole trip into Gaza, crawling through those tunnels, and absolutely no fear whatsoever. When we were detained by Hamas, we're taken into the prison compound. No fear. Absolutely none. Not even a little bit of worry. Nothing. You know, so I really believe you can get through any situation by being in the right energetic state and knowing who and what you are, and not just you believing it, you know it. People say, I try to believe this stuff, how can I believe it the way you do? And I say, well, if you're trying to believe it, it's because you don't know it. Why would you try to believe something you don't know? If you know it, then why are you trying to believe it? I don't have to believe it because I know it. And that's the way it works, you know? And I believe it makes a difference.
I wish I should have asked you guys if I can record the after hours conversation, because I had a feeling it was going to get really good. But
actually, I've just got my Pamela's still running. This is all still being recorded, actually. So.
Oh, fantastic! Yes,
wonderful.
Definitely send it to me. I'll include it in the archives.
My Skype's really bad at the moment. It's taking me like 2.5 hours to send like a 12 meg file over Skype. There's something going on with my Skype. They're really trying to push me back at the moment. They've repressed my YouTube channel, my Skype bandwidth. And I can download stuff. Everything's great. It's just Skype. I can't transfer files on Skype.
I'm experiencing the same thing. Cherie will try to send me something, and we're in the same house sitting 2 feet away from each other, and it takes forever through Skype.
Yeah, or it just doesn't accept it at all.
Yeah, I can attest to the frequency thing, because it's come to a point with me, and I'm knocking on wood here, just, you know, because I don't want to jinx myself. But I can, no matter what kind of police encounter I have, they just go away. There's something about the energy. They come in and they try to do what they're doing. They pull us over. Or I just had an encounter the other day where they were demanding ID and all of this. And I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. And we moved on to the next thing. And before I knew it was gone. I mean, we were done with the situation. So
there is something to resonating at that higher frequency, and there's no fear anymore. And maybe that's what it all comes down to, is the lack of fear. And when you're not resonating that fear frequency, then those who feed upon the fear frequency simply cannot act because they have nothing to feed upon. And so maybe that's what it's all about, not resonating in the fear frequency, and you automatically push off anybody that is a predator of that fear frequency.
Yeah, absolutely, you do. Yeah. And it's treating them like people as well. You know, these guys are people. They're just doing what they're doing because they're programmed. You know, some of them are sociopaths, some of them are bad people, but often they're programmed into that as well. So, you know, it's you know, just treating them with respect and treating yourself with respect and realizing you're just dealing with people, you know. And you can this whole name thing and name game and lose a name, win the game. There's a lot to this, but I'm getting a lot of people thinking that this is, they're free because they do this. You know, they're driving around and they're doing their stuff and they're kind of in this state of narcissism and they're ignoring the rest of the world. And I keep saying to people, you're not free if you lose the name. You're free when they stop asking you for it.
Right.
So, you know, people need to continue to pay attention. It's an important piece of the puzzle, but it's not remedy. The remedy is when, you know, the people start to respect each other enough to stand up and have a strong communal response to what the criminals who are running our government are doing. And they're all criminals. Every single government on this planet is a criminal government. Well, virtually everyone. Anyone that's supporting Israel, anyone that's supporting this fake war on terror, anyone that's supporting America's war posturing against Russia, all these people are criminals. I mean, Barack Obama reckons he can go and execute anybody. You've got people being tortured in Guantanamo Bay. Executive orders where he can bypass Congress. He's a criminal. He's a criminal. Why don't the people stand up and say, hey, you're a criminal. You got to leave now. You know, it's really that simple. Yeah. We've got to grow a pair. We've all got to just grow a pair and have a strong communal response to these criminal scumbags. Because if we don't, we're allowing the world to be destroyed because we're abiding by the rules that these criminals wrote to tie us up in red tape for years on end.
Tell you what happened to us recently. We saw this homeless guy, and he was kind of muttering to himself, and he was completely tattered clothes and hair messed up, and he looked the typical homeless look.
Yeah.
And so we stopped and got him something to eat. And I couldn't find him, so we drove around, and then I finally found him, and I go to give him something to eat. And I figured at the time while we were looking for him, I said, you know what, Sheree, why don't you record this? Let's put this out there and do like the ice bucket challenge, but a random act of kindness challenge. And so as soon as we get up to him, he starts cussing out. And he's accusing Sheree of filming him and uploading it to YouTube and or Facebook. And I said, no, if you don't want to be filmed, that's perfectly fine. We just wanted to get you something to eat. And here we're deleting the video. Then he starts threatening to kill us and to kill Sheree.
Wow.
And just goes into this complete rage. And so I said, you know what? I think it's a good idea to we should call somebody. Because we can't have somebody like this walking around. I don't know if this guy's dangerous or if he's just crazy or what's going on. So we called the police. The police show up. They are demanding my identification as if I'm the criminal. And I explained I was just getting this guy something to eat. But it doesn't surprise me because just recently a 90-year-old guy was thrown in jail for feeding the homeless. So maybe that should have been my cue right there not to do that. But I'm reminded of that story because you were talking about resonating in a higher frequency. And that's exactly what I was doing during that encounter. She was insisting on searching the car. She was insisting on getting my driver's license. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. That's exactly what I said. No, we're not going to do that. Okay, now let's move on to what's going on. This guy threatened to kill us. But it's La La Land. It's backwards. It's upside down. You go to feed a homeless guy. He's threatening to kill you. And then the police are wanting to search your car and demanding identification. This is the world we live in.
That's a very strange thing. I wonder what his background was. I wonder what happened to him to make him like that.
I don't know, but people were saying that most likely it was military. We live here in Colorado Springs, which is heavy, heavy military industrial complex, and people were speculating he could have been in the military, MK Ultra type of situation, and they just let these people loose here. You see them all over the place. It's really creepy. I don't know.
Part of the plan,
I can only speculate to the background. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, all part of the plan, I would say.
I think so. But it made me think twice about feeding homeless people now, so maybe that is part of the plan.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, but he sounds like he's been damaged in some way. I mean, he must have been damaged in some way to react like that.
Yeah. I didn't stick around to find out. I just, you know, my first instinct is you threatened my wife, and I don't care who you are, but that's not going to fly. And then I almost got out of the car, and it could have turned into a much worse situation. But then something grabbed a hold of me, and I said, okay, hold on. Let's take a step back and just calm down for a minute, and let's call somebody out here who may be able to take this guy off the street if he's dangerous.
Right.
Which now, in hindsight, looking at that, could have turned into a bad situation, because it just goes again to reinforce the idea, never call the police, never call the police, never call the police. So, you know, what do you do in a situation like this? You've got a crazy guy walking around threatening to kill your wife. I'm not worried about our safety, but what about the next guy out there?
Yeah.
What if it was somebody that wasn't able to grab a hold of the situation like I did and really put things in perspective? Because I almost got it. And just like every other man would, I almost got out and really beat this guy's ass. He could have been carrying a knife or a gun or something like that, and it could have turned into a much worse situation.
Yeah, you
got to
be careful
situation.
Who you fight with, brother. You got to be careful who you pick fights with. You don't know what they're capable of or what they might be holding. I'll tell you an interesting story about Freemasons. a friend of mine, young guy, 28 or something, joined the Freemasons about 3 years ago, wanted to know what it's about. I thought, okay, I'm going to join. This guy come up, and because he's an upstanding young citizen, this guy come up and offered him membership of the Freemasons, and he thought, interesting, you know, that I've been asked to join the Freemasons, you know. Oh yeah, we've been watching you, you're a fine upstanding young citizen. He's a good looking healthy guy, really fit, really strong, paleo diet, looks like Superman, like the healthiest guy you've ever freaking seen, you know. And beautiful young wife, does charity work, you know. He thought, okay, well, gee, I might join just so I can get a bit of inside info and see what it's all about, you know. Like, not really because I want to be a Freemason, but just to go and see what's going on, you know. I'm saying, yeah, I don't know, man, like, be careful of some of these rituals that they get you doing, because these rituals may seem like little innocent rituals, but really you're operating in realms you can't perceive with senses you don't know you have. And you don't know what sort of energetic resonances you're setting up. You don't know what little doorways you're opening up. You don't know what you're letting in by doing these rituals, you know. And, you know, after a while he's saying, oh, no, look, these are good people. I think they're really misunderstood and they're all my mates and all this sort of stuff. And he's kind of getting sucked into this, you know. And suddenly he's getting elevated through all sorts of degrees, and he's doing all sorts of rituals that, oh yeah, I've been asked to come and join this, you know, and guys are going, well shit, I've been in the Freemasons for 20 years and I haven't been asked to go and do that yet, you know. So they really elevated him through all of these rituals. And then while I'm away, while I was over in England, I was actually in Cornwall, and I get a call from his wife to say, Grant's been arrested. He's been held in the nut house. And we don't know what's going on. And I've got a barrister and all this sort of stuff to try and bail him out. And Grant's gone completely, turned into someone else basically one night. He's gone to do this particular ritual, which was the ritual of the arches, right? The ritual of the arch, what Chris was talking about before. He's gone to do this ritual. Then he's come home and he's gone to bed without dinner, which was very unusual for him. And then he's got up in the middle of the night and he's getting messages on his phone that he had to drive to this certain area. All these maps are coming up on his phone. They're guiding him, guided him to a place that he's never been to before called Hope Island. It's about an hour and a half drive from his house. He's wearing a dressing gown. He's got up, put on a dressing gown, nothing underneath it, stark naked underneath this dressing gown, got in his truck, driven up to this place, got directed to this house by a map, got told to climb over the back fence by his phone, went over the back fence, got directed to a wrench, picked up this big wrench, climbed back over the fence, got back into the car, went to this building, pushed this button to get into the house. The security guard let him into the building because he thought this guy's in a nightgown. He obviously lives here. He pushed this woman's, this particular woman's address and said, she said, who is it? He said, it is I. She came down and then he went to hit her with the wrench, and something inside him said, if you hit this woman with this wrench, you're going to lose your connection to the divine. And he pushed the wrench away, so he didn't actually hit her. It just glanced down, went down the side of it, didn't actually hit her. And the security guard standing there the whole time while he did this, security guard watched him lift the wrench, watched him strike out at the woman, and when he pushed his hand away, it was then that the security guard grabbed his hand and said, oh, you've tried to attack this woman, blah, blah, blah. And it was then that he had this complete breakdown and basically turned into this other personality and ended up locked up for 2 months. And it's like he was programmed as a Manchurian candidate, but he broke the programming. Mm. He was too strong for them, broke the programming. And when he did, his mind fractured. But he'd just gone through all mm-hmm. of these degrees or something of Freemasonry in 3 years. You know, and you look at this guy, he's the perfect assassin. Good looking young guy, fit as a bull. Took 6 cops to hold him down, you know. And they want to know what steroids he takes, what they've never seen anybody so strong. What martial arts does he do? What steroids does he take? He goes, look, I do 7 chin-ups and 7 push-ups every day, and I go surfing every day, and I eat a paleo diet. And they wouldn't believe him, you know. But it's almost like he went through this whole Manchurian candidate thing. He only got out of hospital 2 weeks ago. She actually rang me up in Cornwall. I got a barrister friend of mine to actually go in because that was all could get in to see him. The lawyer couldn't get in. No one could get in. They wouldn't let anybody in to see him. They had him. They were beating him up. They had him in solitary. They were doing terrible things to him. He ended up in the nut house for 2 months. He's out now. He's on like so much medication, diazepam, temazepam, like all this crap, which is completely fucking him up. And we've got to try to get him off all this. But it really seems like a program, like he was programmed by the Freemasons to go and kill this woman or something, you know?
I'm glad. Wow. I'm really glad you shared that because I've been thinking about joining a lodge for that exact reason, so mm-hmm. I can get in there and get firsthand information.
Be very careful. Chris,
it's about.
Be very, very careful, mate. Yeah, because they elevated this guy through so many degrees, and like his ego was letting him do it. Oh yeah, it's because I'm good and I'm this and I'm that, and hey, you know, like his ego was going with it, you know. And he went and did this ritual of the archers, and then his whole life turned to shit after that ritual. And I don't know, man. I really, really wonder about it. You know, I wonder what this woman's. Connection to Freemasonry is. Has she got somewhere? Is there some business she's involved in with someone in Freemasons? Maybe she was just a test case. Maybe they were just setting up to see if he could do it. You know, but why did the guard let him do it as well? Was the guard in on it? How did he get... And Jen was getting messages on the phone, on his phone, because he didn't take his phone with him. No, he did, but she got the phone back, and she's getting messages on the phone that, are you okay? And she'd try to text the number back or call the number back, and it would say this number is not connected. And then she'd get a message from the same number again an hour later, are you okay? And she'd try to call back, this number is not connected. So weird, weird things going on. And they approached him, they brought him into their fold, they elevated him, and then he's off doing this weird shit. So that's the thing, you know, like I often say, you've got a lot of higher senses. And you're interacting with things in manners that you don't know. That's how they set up this whole geometric grid, like I was talking about before with you know, Euclid's 30-second supposition, or all the geometry we're surrounded by. We're interacting with this with higher senses in realms we can't perceive, with senses we don't know we have. And that's what these little Freemason rituals do. You might just think, oh, I'm turning here, and I'm doing this, and I'm drinking this, and I'm standing this way, and I'm wearing this thing. But it's setting up this energetic resonance. It's doing something else in a realm that you can't see outside visible light. And it's opening up a doorway for control of your mind and control of you in all sorts of manners. That's a lot of what this Freemasonry stuff does. So if you're going to join the Freemasons, Chris, be very, very careful of these rituals because they open up these doorways. And if they can use you in some way, I'm sure they will. And what just happened to my young friend is a fine example of that.
Wow. Well, you're making me think twice now. There's been something energetically that it's been pulling me towards it. But again, there's been something blocking me from it as well. Because I've been in several different towns now where we have a lodge where I can just go right down. I have a couple of friends who are Freemasons who will vouch for me as well. And I've been called to it. But then again, I never actually get out there to go to the lodge. Something keeps stopping me. Maybe it's some kind of higher protection that is trying.
Well, maybe you needed to hear that story about my friend first.
Yes, no, for sure, because I am thinking twice about it now. You know, the couple of Freemasons that I know, they seem to be really nice people. One of our hosts, Donnie Gilson.
I don't think Freemasons are bad people at all. I don't think most of them know what they're doing. Like I said, this other guy had been in this lodge 20 years. He hadn't gone through anywhere near the amount of levels that my friend had gone through. So a lot of the lower level Freemasons are probably good people who do good things for their community. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff that's done by the Freemasons. You got to look at it. It's the higher levels where the weird shit goes on, you know. And when you look at what just happened to my friend, there's something really weird about that because this is so out of character for this guy. This guy is the most level-headed guy, charity worker, a beautiful, beautiful guy. Really, really lovely man. Beautiful Filipino wife. He's 28. She's 26. They got two beautiful kids. Yeah, absolutely wonderful guy. Heart of gold, would never do anything like this, never had any type of mental problems at all, you know, and suddenly he's not himself, and he's off trying to kill this woman in this place he's never been because he's been told to do so by his phone, you know, after going and doing all the levels of Freemasonry in 3 years, straight after doing this ritual of the arches. So, you know.
Thank you for sharing that.
I'll look up that particular ritual because I've got Mackie's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry and it's got all the rituals
look it up.
In there.
It's something like the Ritual of the Arches or the Ritual of the Arch or the Ritual of the Golden Arch.
Oh yeah, there's a ton of rituals that have got the word arch in the title of the ritual.
I'll find out from him exactly what the ritual was. And I'll send you a message on it. I don't think he's on.
There's the Holy Royal Arch. There's the ritual for the Royal Arch degree.
Yep.
Yeah, there are dozens of these. Somebody to ask would be Robert Sullivan.
Robert W. Sullivan.
Yeah, we've had him on many times. He wrote a book called The Royal Arch of Enoch. And he's a high-level Freemason, openly talks about this. He talks about how Freemasonry was usurped, how it was used for evil. He seems pretty genuine and pretty open as far as the questioning. The only thing that he won't answer are specifics like secret handshakes and things like that. But other than that, he seems pretty open. And between him and Donnie Gilson, I started thinking, well, maybe these people aren't these evil devils, you know, that are hiding their horns under their yarmulkes.
not all lodges are the same, you see. So, you know, you get some lodges which are very, very independently minded, and they're on the borderline of being described as irregular lodges because they have nothing to do with the Grand Lodge of England. And then you get lodges where nearly every single member is a member of the Ordo Templi Orientis. Or a member of the Coronzon Club, and the OTO are allowed to rent Masonic temples for their own OTO rituals.
I'm aware of the OTO for sure. Know,
yeah, and then, you know, if you fall in with a bad lodge like that, they're not going to have the Bible or the Quran or, you know, a traditional spiritual book as, you know, because they usually open the lodge with some kind of religious book on the lectern. You're going to end up with the Goetia or some demonological text. And then you're going to run into a lot of problems because once you've been a member, you know, even just for a few months, they're not going to like the fact that you've become an unmember.
Okay.
You get my drift.
How do we get to the truth of the matter? Because that's ultimately what it's about. Let's get down to the nitty-gritty truth. What is it that's inside of their libraries? What is the secret information that they've either been hiding or safeguarding, one or the other? And from my understanding, Freemasonry was formed with the Knights Templar, as you said, but it was due to the safeguarding of scientific and mystic information from the suppression of the
Yeah. Well, what you've got to look at is you've got to look at being a member of Freemasonry. If you are a Freemason, you're kind of in the middle ground of this occult ladder. And the bottom rungs of the ladder are the Rotary Clubs, the Great White Brotherhood, and the Ancient Order of Druids. And a lot of people join the Rotary Club, and then they find that the guy sitting next to them is a Freemason, and they get an invitation. So then you go to the next level, which is Freemasonry. And I'm talking about, you know, just your straightforward Freemasonry. And then you start getting into the Knights Templar. And basically, once you've crossed that breach, you are getting very close to being involved in rituals where they are mentioning the names of demons.
Okay.
I mean, the Baphomet and all this kind of thing, the Templars weren't tortured for no reason. It's because they were stamping on the cross, and they learned themselves a technique of necromancy, which is where you take the head of a freshly severed body, a freshly severed head from a freshly dead body, and you pickle it with human blood and opium, and you put it in a jar, you seal it with wax, and you stick it in the ground for about 6 weeks. And then you say all kinds of incantations. You bring this head out. Obviously, it's undergone some weird chemical reaction. It looks rather kind of mummified and dried. And then they stuck that in a silver casket. And that is really basically what the Baphomet was of the Templars. And then once you start getting involved in that kind of thing, you know, it's not a slippery slope any longer. You've actually slipped.
Right. My understanding of the Knights Templar, and this is after speaking with Donnie Gilson, who is a Knights Templar, and Robert Sullivan, but then again, they could be, you know, not giving all the information. I don't know. That's the reason why I want to see this firsthand for myself. But my understanding of the Knights Templar is you take an oath to protect Jesus Christ. That's what a Knights Templar does.
Yes. Well, obviously, that is on the surface rituals. And that's exactly how they got their charter and how they got their permission to exist in the first place from the Pope. They were meant to be just protecting, like warrior monks, the pilgrims. Now, all of the rituals that were, you know, publicly known, none of that was any problem, Chris. They weren't ruffling a single feather with the Vatican. In actual fact, there was a... I think he was a bishop, a French bishop, and he even traveled all the way to see the Pope and put a good word in for the Knights Templar. What was happening, though, is that, you know, there was a central core, a secret cult within the cult that started to analyze and translate books in Arabic. These were Arabian books of magic that had been brought back from the Crusades, and they started to use a kind of fusion of this Arabic magic from the book called The Picatrix with, you know, the Kabbalistic or pre-Kabbalistic demonology. And that's where it went wrong.
Okay.
That's where it all went wrong, you see. Because you had a cult inside a cult. Now, this is exactly what the Bavarian Illuminati were. They were a cult operating inside normal European gentlemanly Freemasonry. And they used Freemasonry as a recruiting ground. Now, Freemasonry uses Rosicrucian groups and the Rotary Club as a recruiting ground. But unfortunately, what happens at the other end of the scale is that once you get past the 22nd, 23rd, 24th degree of standard Scottish Rite Masonry, you start bumping into visiting Masons, and they're all members of the Ordo Templi Orientis. And you start getting invitations to stay behind after your normal Masonic ritual is over. And then the OTO people move in at about midnight,
And then you start realizing, oh, there's women here as well. And some of those women are naked. And then they're passing little pots of menstrual blood around in a circle. And that's when you know you've got yourself into a very, very sticky situation, because they're not going to be very happy with you just excusing yourself, saying, you know what, it's getting late and I'd like to go home now. Because you know their names, or you know what they look like, and by then it's too late for you.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. See, I wouldn't engage in any rituals.
Yeah.
I would like to learn.
I have to say, Chris, it gets even heavier and worse than that. Because above the OTO, you've then got the Corazon Club, and there's even the Palladian Rite, and then there's the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim. And then after that, you've got the Cult of Lamb. Then it goes into really sick serial killer type cults like the Order of the Nine Angles. I mean, I've researched all these people, and then there's a bunch of witches who are also Freemasons called the Wheel.
I've heard of the Wheel.
And you really do not want to get mixed up with these people, because they are really nasty. I mean, in Italy, you've got cardinals and priests who are also Masons and also members of the Corazon Club, which is all basically sex magic based on the original OTO teachings. And, you know, they're writing their own grimoires, some of these people, which are kind of instruction manuals of how to do rituals to summon demons. And once you start rubbing shoulders with those types of people, you know, they're not going to be very friendly at all if you start then telling people about that on air.
Of course. To my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, please, because this is information that I really needed, because you know, up until Max told me the story and you shared this information, I started to question the whole conspiracy theories behind the Masons. But ones that I speak to, they tell a story of usurpation, where the Freemasons were usurped at some point in time, and there was a split.
Yeah.
And there are the lodges that do practice the dark and the lodges that practice the light.
Yeah, that's right.
Would that be correct? Okay.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, blimey, there's been more than one schism. I mean, what we've got at the moment in Britain is you've got the United Grand Lodge, which is based in Queen Street near Covent Garden in London, and that is called Grand East. And all regular Masonic lodges worldwide, and it's the USA, Greece, Turkey, you know, Japan, Africa, you name it, Grand East is the main regulatory body of Masonic law. But there's been so many schisms. They had an argument, you know, and now we've got two supreme councils of Freemasonry of the 33rd degree, one in London, one in Edinburgh in Scotland. So there's two supreme councils. Then up in the north of England, you've got Royal Arch Freemasonry, which has got a different number of degrees, and that's the one that got the police officers into a lot of trouble when it was revealed in the 1970s that I think after the 13th degree, they give you permission to kill your wife if she's not agreeable to you. And then there's oaths, you know, from one brethren to another, saying even if you know that your fellow brother is in the wrong, you still have to stay by his side and be, you know, strong and supportive of him.
I have heard that, yeah.
Yeah, so that's Royal Arch Freemasonry. That's popular in the north of England. Then you've got Co-Masonry, which is all women, and that's in France, and that's got a ton of satellite sisterhoods where it's all women. There's no blokes involved at all. And I've interviewed some of them. Some of them are pretty innocent, but others are pretty much involved in
you know, kind of hexes, cursing, spells. Some of them make money on eBay. I mean, a large percentage of eBay's earnings now is from the occult and all the occult listings to do with hexes, curses, voodoo dolls, candles, candle magic kits, you name it.
You know, I've seen those, and I've wondered if they're legit or if it's just people scamming each other.
Oh, I mean, there's a ton of scams, but I mean, some of them are legitimate. And the Obeya is a flavor of voodoo, and there's a lot of voodoo priests who are also Freemasons. Now, Caribbean Freemasonry has got a different slant to it. And the reason for that is because it's more from a Roman Catholic point of view, whereas British Freemasonry is essentially it's Judaism. It's kind of based on the Kabbalah, and then that's fused with, you know, they sing sort of adjusted Christian hymns before they do their rituals. Caribbean Freemasonry is more Roman Catholic, and the reason for that is because those people, a lot of the Masons, are actually members of various Obeya and Palo Oyimbi voodoo sects.
I was just about to ask if it goes back to French voodoo. Yeah.
Yeah, and what happened is that the voodoo rituals were not liked by, you know, the slave owners. And so, you know, the slave owners were saying to the slaves, look, you know, what on earth are you up to? We don't like you doing this stuff. So to hide the voodoo that they were doing, they substituted the names of the Loas, that's the Loas are voodoo spirits, they substituted their normal names with the names of Roman Catholic saints. And all of this has blurred the edges of Caribbean Freemasonry as well. So it's a very, very complicated situation. If you start getting involved with those types of people, what will happen is eventually, you know, they'll trust you and they'll invite you to these types of ceremonies, which I've filmed for my new film, where, say, somebody wants a job and they want, or they want a raise or they want promotion. They go to these rogue voodoo mason type priests who specialize in curses and specialize in hexes. And they will hex someone who's got a job that you want. And I've actually filmed it, and it's in my new film. And they pay, you know, quite a lot of money. It's about $500 or something, for, you know, to make somebody go blind or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Now,
wow.
once you start getting involved with those types of people, you really, you know, you've gone too far, really, because they may take a disliking to you being on the radio or something like that, and then they might start following you in the car.
Well, that's always been a big question. If I did go to a lodge and they realized that I was on the radio, they probably wouldn't even let me into the first degree, much less anything else.
Well, there are a lot of broadcasters. You see, Freemasonry is Jewish in its upper echelons, and Jews control Freemasonry. All of those stiff upper lip British aristocrats who are in charge of the rule books of World International Freemasonry, they are Jewish. They're Jewish British aristocrats. And the royal family is Jewish. So Jewish people in the media are, a lot of them are members of Freemasonry. But this also explains why it's only truth frequency, really, and I don't see these types of shows on these types of subjects being broadcast anywhere else.
No, you're absolutely right. Oh, really, when you think about it, it is career suicide, because if you speak out against Israel, then the affiliates aren't going to pick you up, and then it's just going to create a whole snowball effect to where you're essentially blackballed. But that's why we're building truth frequency. Yeah, exactly. That's why we're building truth frequency.
I came across a website which was an encyclopedia of Jewish family names. And it's very obvious they actually look at your name nowadays. And I'm talking about everywhere, whether it's a job interview, or whether you're signing up for an account on Alexa, or you're signing up for an account with one of these Jewish-owned household-branded websites, they will check you out. And they have a list of Jewish names.
I wonder Jewish what family names. If we signed up with Alexa with a Jewish name.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah. You know what happened? What happened recently? And Alex Jones actually did an article on this. Alexa decided to drop all the rankings. I think we talked about this. Alexa decided to drop all the rankings of any website that is anti-establishment.
Yes. Yes, that's right. I mean, listen, what they're doing, I mean, especially Facebook. Facebook have created this enormous mapped brain. Where anyone who posts anything which is exposing the agenda for a greater Israel on any of their timelines or any of their Facebook pages, their IP, their name, and all of their personal information, plus all their friends who like, who click like on those types of posts, are blackballed by Facebook. And that's why the Truth Frequency membership number is going down or is stalled, and it's the same reason why FYB magazine got up to nearly 48,000 people and it's just stuck, even though we're getting, you know, 80, 90 or 100 likes a week. It's stuck.
Yeah, I do see that happening on YouTube. I posted a video. Yeah. Other websites were reporting almost a million views on other websites. These weren't even views coming from our site. This is other websites which we can monitor. And YouTube was reporting 10,000 or something like that.
Yeah, and this also explains why Wikipedia tend to target people. I had Jim Fetzer as a guest, and he explained to me that the Wikipedia editors just weren't willing to allow him to publish what he wanted on Wikipedia. And, of course, Jimmy Wales, who owns Wikipedia, is Jewish. I don't think there's a single website in the top 10 websites that isn't owned by somebody who's Jewish. And I just watched a movie, The Manchurian Candidate, a very good film with Denzel Washington. And I watched all the trailers of recent films. And it's just amazing. I mean, every single person from the costume designer to props to the actors on the screen, the directors, the producers, they're all Jewish. And it makes me wonder what kind of Hollywood, what kind of creativity are we missing out on?
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying Jewish people aren't creative. There's a lot of very creative and talented Jewish people. There's no question about it. And they're also very, very good at negotiations in business. Look at Brian Epstein, very, very clever people. But how better would the world be if we weren't being blackballed?
Right, right. They have set up their power control, their power structure throughout all the governments, throughout Hollywood, throughout media, the banking systems. Yeah. They have pretty much everything locked down.
Now, in the interview between Jesse Ventura and David Icke, where Jesse Ventura is ridiculing David Icke about the reptilian information, which obviously, if you listen to the show that I did with Fritz Springmeier, he really was way ahead of David Icke on this whole thing, and he basically says it's all sensationalized by David Icke. In the interview between Jesse Ventura and David Icke, I'm pretty sure, I'm about 80% sure, that at one point Jesse Ventura says, well, I'm Jewish. Now, he's running on a ticket. He's running on a ticket with Howard Stern, who's also Jewish.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll end up with a Jewish, if they won, you'd end up a Jewish president and a Jewish vice president who have interest in the media.
Wow. I never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
But I do remember when this whole Gaza Israel thing blew up last time, just a couple of months ago. Howard Stern was one of the first people to come out and support Israel, in support of Israel. And I found that to be deplorable because Israel was committing wars against crimes against humanity, war crimes.
Well, listen, John Voight, you know John Voight, he's the father of Angelina Jolie.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't made that many films, but the films he's made have been, you know, pretty good, like The Deer Hunter. He wrote a letter, an open letter, supporting Israel and more or less saying, you know, that Israel has a right to kill anyone in self-defense. Well, what happened is that that open letter was published, and then 150 movers and shakers and celebrities and agents, talent scouts and everyone to do with the Hollywood industry signed a letter of support for him, for John Voight, and for Israel. In this list of 150 Hollywood celebrities, there's some surprising names who come out, and they are obviously Jewish. Sylvester Stallone is Jewish. Arnold Schwarzenegger is Jewish.
Minnie Driver.
Yeah. Rio, what's her name? She got busted for shoplifting.
Winona Ryder.
That's not her real name, by the way. Her real name is some Jewish name. Natalie Portman is Jewish, and she actually speaks Hebrew. And she's on, like, Israeli TV. There's clips of her. She's chatting away in Hebrew.
Yeah, she has dual citizenship.
Yeah.
Yeah, she went to university.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think she studied in Israel.
Isn't it something like 172 members of Congress, or was it 72 members of Congress are dual citizens of Israel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It was a large number of people. And there's also, I think, 9 people in the White House close to the Oval Office who also have dual citizenship. But, I mean, look at Kissinger. He's Jewish. And, you know, Kissinger Associates is really basically providing the script and the on-message script, if you like, that all of the politicians follow. So...
Right. Right.
When you look at the nuts and bolts of it and how the daily political agenda influences then the news agenda, and then the mainstream news agenda is then influencing all of the bloggers and the YouTubers and all the truthers, people like Kev, who does 2 videos a day on YouTube, where he's reflecting and commenting on whatever is being reported on the mainstream media. You can see that that entire swathe of media, including all those millions of blogs in the blogosphere and all of those tens of thousands of YouTube clips, they're all being influenced from, you know, a biased original source. And the bias is biased towards this greater Israel, the invasion and occupation of Iraq, the destruction of the current administration in Syria. That's it.
So then how do we defeat this enemy that has its octopus tentacles in pretty much everything? Because I've seen people – let me say this. There's been actresses and actors who have spoken out against Israel. They never work again. There are musicians who have made it in the music industry on their own without being controlled by some type of Israeli or Jewish owned record label. They're either killed or they're set up on drug charges or even worse, child abuse charges.
Yeah, well, Louis Farrakhand, there's a fascinating lecture, a public lecture by Louis Farrakhand, where he's discussing Michael Jackson and a few of the blues, the black guys who got made it big in jazz and blues. And Louis Farrakhand, he says they all had Jewish managers.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, the black guys had the talent, but the Jewish guys ended up earning the money. You know, and it's a fascinating speech. So
I think that, you know, we are dealing with what I call the glass ceiling. And, you know, you can write books like I do and do all of the marketing yourself, because you'll never get a book deal, because the book publishers, like I say, every sector of the media, I'm sure, is referencing this encyclopedia of Jewish names. There's no two ways about it. I'm sure that's what's going on, because, you know, I've done good books. I've done good documentaries. I've done good TV shows. I've done high quality work all my life. But somehow there's always a glass ceiling that stops things from going viral, that blocks you from, you know, doing business deals. And all of a sudden you send an email off to a company that you want to do some kind of marketing deal with, and you never get a reply.
Right, right. I've noticed that as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And this glass ceiling exists in publishing, exists in the record business, in radio, and in television. I mean, this whole thing with Sirius. I bet you the owners of Sirius are Jewish. Now, I don't know this for sure, but I would say probably George Nori is Jewish as well. I don't know that, but I would be very surprised if he wasn't.
Hmm.
So, you know, this is the situation, and it's a pretty serious situation. It really is. I don't really see any kind of brightness on the horizon in terms of what we're doing, because my main marketing tool is emails. If I send out 20, 30, 40,000 emails, I can run my business really well. If I send out 50 or 60,000 emails, I get quite a good income. I have to do that every single day. Now they're starting to mutter about email is going to be obliterated off the face of the internet, and you're only going to have WhatsApp and these real-time chat systems. Just look at what they've done to the internet. Look at what they've done in terms of setting up these garden-walled things. The followers and the subscribers on all these websites, like the subscribers on YouTube, the bosses of YouTube, who are all Jewish, by the way, there was only one non-Jewish guy, and they just paid him off, and he went off, and he's on his own now. His name is Jawed Akim, or something like that. They're Jewish, and they know who these subscribers are. They've got the email addresses of all of the subscribers on YouTube, and they know what those subscribers are interested in. They know what videos they watch, what subjects they like, and they even use that data to suggest what kind of subjects that you might be interested in when you go onto YouTube.
Right.
But you, as a channel owner, you're not allowed to see the email addresses of your own subscribers.
Oh, well, not only that, but they're not even putting subscribed videos on people's pages anymore.
Uh-uh.
I see.
We had 30,000 subscribers at one point. We woke up one day, and we weren't using YouTube very much, but we woke up one day, and there was 20,000. And then another day, there was 14,000. And then another day, there was 10,000. Yeah. Now we're down to 4,000. We upload a video, 100 views. 150 views. It's not even worth it. That's why I don't even use YouTube, because it's just simply not worth it.
Yeah, and what I'm getting at is that Facebook have frozen pages owned by people who've been critical of Gaza and have mentioned the Z word, Zionism. YouTube are doing the same kind of thing. What about the spam cop type websites? Who the hell are those people? Who are these idiots who go around blacklisting you for sending out an email to your subscribers?
People have been doing this everywhere. They've frozen my Facebook pages because of my stance on Gaza. I got the entire Bluehost server got shut down because of the Crow House the other day. There was a denial of service attack on my website. It was 6.5 million forum posts per minute.
Oh, man.
And that shut down the whole service. They had to take my site offline for a while. So, and they've limited my YouTube account, so I can only upload 15-minute videos now because of my last video, which was called ISIS, the Muslim Menace and the Greater Israel Project. And I didn't like that. So they're doing everything they can to suppress us. But, you know, I think the best thing we can do is shine a light on it the way we are, because the wheels are falling off. These people are running scared. They really are. There's so many people now realize that there's something terribly wrong. They don't know what it is, but they know there's something terribly wrong. They know we can't keep just fighting all these bullshit wars and all this crap that we're doing. Like Obama now, what, sending 1,500 troops, 1,500 troops to Iraq and wanting another $5.6 billion in war funding? I mean, you know, people are realizing that something's terribly wrong, and I think that it's just imploding. Did you see Putin's speech, Chris Everard?
No, I didn't. In actual fact, I don't really like Putin, and I think that the guy is two-faced. I mean, all leaders are two-faced.
This speech was great, man. It had some of the points he made were just like, that's what I mean. It's amazing to hear Putin actually speaking some sense. One point that he made, he said here, Russia has no intention of going fishing in the murky waters created by America's ever-expanding empire of chaos. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that is brilliant. That is brilliant, you know?
But that's exactly what it is.
You know, Russia does not wish for chaos to spread. It does not want war. It has no intention of starting one. However, it sees the outbreak of global war as almost inevitable and is prepared for it. Russia doesn't want war, but nor does she fear it, you know. It's basically to sum it up, children, put away your toys. Now is the time for the adults to make decisions. Russia is ready for this, is the world, you know.
Mm.
Wow.
The thing is that they fund Russia Today.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Russia Today has a budget that is provided by the Kremlin. Let's just look at Russia Today. A lot of truthers think Russia Today is the best thing since sliced bread because it has lots of shows and articles which are exposing corruption in the White House. I'm all for that, but at the same time, I want to analyze who these people are. Who are they? They're Jews. They're Russian Jews.
They are.
Larry King has skipped out and he's defected from CNN. And he's now doing the Larry King show on Russia Today.
Are you serious?
Martin, really?
Larry King?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
Larry
wow.
King is on, the Larry King show is now Russia Today.
Well, CNN is imploding. Just recently, Dish Network says they're no longer carrying CNN because it's not news. So even mainstream outlets like Dish Network are starting to see what's happening there.
Yeah, that's their own fault, if you ask me, because they started CNN Plus, which was their version of YouTube, encouraging the public to do reports, which they did. I mean, millions of CNN Plus clips were uploaded. There was great stuff on there. Last time I went to CNN Plus, it was brilliant. And yet they didn't broadcast any of those independent, you know, amateur reporters, who a lot of them were better than the people you see on the main CNN channel. So it's their own fault. They've got an amazing resource there, which they created to try and compete with YouTube, but they didn't want to give those people a leg up into the media industry. But Abby Martin, by the way, as a surname is a Jewish name. Okay, George Martin, the producer of the Beatles, he's friends with Brian Epstein. They're both Jewish. And Abby Martin, I'm sure, is Jewish. You know, so you got Larry King, and then the money's coming from the Kremlin.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to look at these things for what they are. The People Power Revolution in the Ukraine resulted in a Jewish guy that used to be one of the senior executives at the National Bank of Ukraine. He's now the prime minister.
Right. I see Russia Today as the Russian version of Democracy Now! Here in the United States. Democracy Now! Is pretty much a Barack Obama arm.
Yeah, look, it serves a purpose, but it certainly serves its own agenda as well. I mean, it's good to see it combating to what the tripe is we're fed on the Western mainstream, but don't think it doesn't have its own agenda, because it does. Well, and even with its support of ISIS and some of the stuff it's saying about ISIS, I mean, you know, you gotta take all of it with a grain of salt, you know.
Mm. And Noam Chomsky just did a speech at the United Nations. I don't know whether you guys saw that. And he was very critical, extremely critical of Israel. But we have to look at it for what it is. Noam Chomsky is also Jewish. And the only reason that he has the opportunity to stand at the United Nations and speak is because he has friends in the media, because he is Jewish. His reputation has been created because he is Jewish. His ability to operate within the media and have his name spread is because he has Jewish connections. And Michael Moore, I'm sure, is Jewish as well. Moore, yeah, is very often a Jewish name.
Yeah, Michael Moore. I definitely don't trust Michael Moore.
Well, I mean, I quite like his style. And some of the things which he's put in his movies, I think, pretty good, because he uses journalistic technique, which is called humanization, where he looks at the crisis and the corruption through the eyes of a person who's been victimized by it. And it's a good journalistic method. But he would, you know, he got a leg up into the industry because Harvey Weinstein,
He does good work.
He skirts
the main issues, you know. He hovers around the topic, but doesn't actually address the real issues. And so, to me, this is controlled, you know.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure at this point that Jimmy Savile, the BBC children's presenter, DJ guy, that died recently, and that molested 300 odd children on BBC premises, I'm sure he's Jewish as well.
Yeah, wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
Wouldn't surprise
me. In actual fact, there's a Wikipedia for serial killers called Murderpedia. And it's got all the serial killers in the history of the world, even like Nero and Hitler, and they're all in there. And there's a huge number of them who are Jewish.
Yeah, okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Now, it's very, very late here. It's 3 a.m. and
yeah.
I need to get some sleep, Max. But it's great to do shows with you. It's great to talk to you again.
Yeah, really good.
Yeah.
I love where we take it. You know, it's good having.
Oh yeah.
It always goes off.
Absolutely. I'm publishing an ebook. I'll send you a copy, Max. It's a digital book. It's fully illustrated. I've written quite a lot of it. It's also a reproduction of a very old Australian book called The Journals of Two Expeditions of Discovery in Northwest and Western Australia.
Okay.
And I'll send you a copy of it, because it's got amazing drawings of very ancient Wanginas in cool. Western Australia.
Cool, cool. Up in the Kimberley region. I've seen some of the paintings in the cave. Amazing.
Yeah. Incredible stuff. So, okay, I'm gonna leave you guys now.
No worries, brother. Good to talk to you. We'll catch up again
soon.
All right, man.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye. Bye.